a biennium, July 1st, 2007 to August 31st, 2009. There were 685 contacts with the office from the public. Those would have been consumers as well as practitioners. 92% of those inquiries were for information only. 8% were or involved allegations of violations of provisions in Chapter 156A. 6% of the contacts resulted in opening an investigation. The investigations, 36% of them alleged sexual contact of some sort, 15% alleged fraudulent or deceptive conduct, 10% involved use of a medical device. So at closing, when we ceased operations on August 31st, there were 49 open and pending investigations. There were no open or pending enforcement actions. Currently, there is no activity occurring on these complaints. And they have not been routed to another location or agency. As of today, there have been, between August 31st and the present, 14 calls or contacts that we have recorded to the program. We have not received any complaints during that time. If we were to receive a complaint, I would determine what needed to be done with it.
So, Mr. Hindemeyer, these 14 are after the unallotment?
Took effect on August 31st.
Okay.
We have had 14 contacts, phone calls, or a letter or something like that.
So essentially they're just sitting there with because there's no staff.
Well, no. You can't assume. Now, I said there are no complaints. The contacts are phone calls, you know, for information. I took one call directly from the city of St. Louis Park asking about what was in the statute, 156A, and how could they comply with it in terms of updating their ordinances for massage therapists.
Okay.
So it's an example. Okay.
What would happen if there was a complaint and there's no staff?
I would have to figure out what to do with it.
Okay.
I think what I maybe can describe is what some of the other resources might be if we were to get a complaint. You may be recall or be aware that last year the legislature registered naturopathic practitioners with the Board of Medical Practice. This year there is a bill that is still active to register massage practitioners. There is always for massage activity that involves any allegation of sexual conduct, recourse to local law enforcement under the criminal statutes. The FDA addresses issues related to unauthorized use or use of devices for for purposes that are to accomplish ends that are unfounded. We also have continued to update and maintain our website that contains information and links related to complementary and alternative healthcare practices. So that's what's currently in place. And if you take that information in the context of the information that I just provided you about the types of complaints, the types of practitioners that we got and that we investigated and took enforcement action on, I think you can see that there is currently or there may be in the future more resources to deal with some of the issues that we saw in while operating the office.
Mr. Hindemeyer, are there anyone practicing under CAM? Or is there a registration process where someone pays a fee to the state that goes into that office currently?
There is not.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, these are unlicensed practitioners, and that was the reason why the activity was fully funded by general funding. That general funding is gone, frankly. And Mr. Handelmeyer and his office have outlined a number of activities that we have taken for what is, in effect, an unfunded activity. I think that, his staff is still showing an interest in serving the groups that have interest or complaints. But, frankly, we just don't have the capacity as an agency to continue to do this activity without any funding.
Is there still a need? I know you listed all the violations and the complaints and stuff. I assume it seems like there's still a need to have that person there to investigate and move on with the complaints.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tao, it is clear that when there is a person there, people access that person for information. But when we lost the funding, that person was reassigned. The phone has an extended absence screening, describing, what has happened and where callers can go for other information. And again, we have a similar kind of message on our website to try and redirect people.
Okay. Are there questions from the members? Okay. Are there? Okay, I assume the Mr. Aiken and Mr. Handelmeyer are finished.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
We do have a couple folks who want to talk on this issue as well. Diane Miller, Gregory Schmidt, Nancy Hone. Just all three of you could just come and go as you like. Introduce yourself for the record, and you may proceed. And we'll take 10 more minutes, and then we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'll make this brief. My name is Gregory Schmidt. I'm president of Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project. The preservation of our healing traditions is as important as the preservation of other cultural traditions and no less important than preservation of biodiversity, natural resources, wildlife, environments, et cetera, et cetera. Chapter 146A is true consumer protection. It was consumers, private citizens who wrote thousands of letters and made thousands of phone calls to legislators urging adoption of a statute which would grant access to information, products, and practitioners of the natural healing arts. We wanted protection from monopolistic, self-serving, big money special interests who use their power, money, and influence to secure legislation that benefited them only and the consumers little or none.
Can we address the issue at hand on alignment of that position and how it could impact your practice?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm a carpenter by trade. I'm not a natural health practitioner. It would not affect me at all.
Okay, then we'll go to Nancy Hone.
My name is Nancy Hone. I'm a traditional naturopath and homeopath. And for 31 years, I'm a former registered nurse. I personally helped found a group, the Minnesota Natural Health Coalition and the Minnesota Health Natural Health Legal Reform Project, to pass this bill. I stand here today as the president of Natural Health Practitioners of Minnesota. So to answer your question, it's been working very well. The natural health practitioners have been able to flourish in our community, which produces very low-cost health care. When health care is a problem today in terms of money, so to close the office makes it difficult. However, we are we understand pulling in our belts, and that if we have to, we have to be sure that 146A maintains its integrity, because the governor has introduced a bill that says they want to repeal the entire statute. So in the Senate, we passed that bill with one dissenting vote. It was a landslide in both houses because the legislators felt comfortable public was being protected, and that's why we must keep the
office. Ms. Hone, I have a question for you. Would your group be opposed to contributing to keeping that position and keep so your folks could continue to operate?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think Mr. Hindelmeyer asked me that last year. And, we earn very little money, and we'd like to. But, you know, I don't know how we could, because the economy is affecting all of us because we don't get insurance payments. So it would be difficult.
Sure.
But we would like to help in any way.
Got it.
Mr. Chair,
yep.
I will throw in $5,000.
Uh-oh.
Very
I'm
good.
I'm an unemployed carpenter, so that's a stretch for me.
We'll put that in the bill just for you.
Oh, my God.
I'll pay that bill.
Diane, your turn. Go.
My name is Diane Miller. I'm an attorney. I was one of the drafter lobbyists for the Minnesota 146A. And I represent the National Health Freedom Coalition. I'm the legal director for them. I'm also representing Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project today. In 2006, this office was unallotted funds, and we talked to the governor's office. The governor's office had no intention of taking away the exemption to the Medical Practice Act, because this statute has an office, but it also has an exemption to medical practice violations. So they said, oh, well, we didn't mean to take away the exemption. We just meant to close the office. So we drafted an amendment, and it closed the office, and it left the exemptions to the medical practice in place that can still be used by prosecutors or other enforcement agencies or other boards, like the medical board or the naturopathic board, to discipline people. So what happens in this bill is that the way that it's drafted, it's an exemption to the Medical Practice Act. And it used to be that the medical practice board could shut someone down for practicing medicine without a license. Now they could shut someone down for going outside of the safe harbor law. So they could still do that now, even if the Office of Complementary and Alternative Practices wasn't there. The AG can shut people down, the boards can shut people down, the criminal prosecutors and counties can still shut people down like they used to before. They just ask a different question, and we want you to leave the different question in statute. We want you to leave the prohibited conduct, 27 paragraphs in statute, and we want you to leave the client bill of rights in statute so that all the unlicensed practitioners can still practice. And then when a licensing bill comes forward, like a naturopathic bill or a massage bill, they can refer to that statute for the unlicensed practitioners, and they don't loop them all into a licensing bill. So that works very nicely, and we just don't want to lose the exemption to the Medical Practice Act. I have drafted the amendment for the amended 146A as it is today, and I have it available if you want to see what that would look like. I think that even if we lose allotment, even if we can't afford that office, which it is really, you know, it's great to have the office because people can call. It's just a complaint office. It's not an oversight office. It's not a licensing board. It's just for taking complaints. It's nice to have that office there. But I work with 30 other states that are getting safe harbor bills going right now. 8 of them have already passed. None of them have special offices. But Minnesota was the first one to go forward. Everybody's really scared, like, oh, my gosh, we're going to do a safe harbor exemption for unlicensed people. It was big in Minnesota, and we all worked really hard on it to get it there. I think it's okay to go back to where we were before if we really have to. I think that the bad practitioners are going to get shut down if we leave prohibited conduct in the statute and if we leave the client bill of rights. And I think the AG or the boards or other resources will be able to take care of the situation. Consumers utilize the unlicensed healers. We're proud of this law. We have a great name across the United States for this law, and I hope that we leave the exemption in even if it's not allotted. Thank you.
Share the amendment with me before you go.
So okay.
Just leave a copy here for the committee. Are there questions for the? Okay. Well, thank you. All right. Let's represent Simon, House File 3212. I will move House File 3212. Recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Health and Human Services. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate your time. I know you have a full agenda. I'll try to be quick. The purpose of this bill is to provide what I think is a modest exclusion for what appears to me, at least, to be kind of a bait and switch that happened between the passage of a statute in 2005 and the promulgation of the administrative rules in 2007. I'm having handed out right now for you, just to sort of cut to the chase, and thank you to the page for her fancy footwork there, just a copy of the statute at issue here. And basically what it comes down to is this. In the statute initially, and I'll have Ms. Garwick-Foley explain to you how this has affected her in particular, in the license renewal requirement, you're getting the statute, if you have it in front of you, it's 148B.54. For this particular position, it starts out in subdivision 2 by saying at the completion of the first 4 years of licensure, and then you look to the second sentence, which is about five lines down, it says thereafter, at the time of renewal, there will be 40 additional clock hours of professional post-degree, et cetera, et cetera. So what appears to have happened is that the word thereafter was interpreted as in addition to. And so what that means is very many people were in the situation that you're about to hear where they thought that thereafter meant thereafter and not in addition to, but they were subjected later on to some sort of additional requirement, and they were caught unaware, and they didn't know this was the case. Now, because of various data restrictions, we don't know exactly how many people were not relicensed for this reason, but we can speculate if you look at the numbers and the drop-off and the number of people who were in the same class of original licensees as Ms. Garwick-Foley here, who you'll meet in a second, that it could be as high as, you know, in the triple digits. Over 100 people were in the same situation. I was contacted by one of those people, and I'll hand it over to her right now to describe her own situation.
Ms. Foley.
Yes, Garwick-Foley. Yes, I'm Chris Garwick-Foley, Mr. Chair and Committee. Thank you. Thank you for giving us time here this evening. I do appreciate it. I was licensed as a licensed professional counselor, number 101, back in November of 2004. And at that time, the requirements, the continuing education requirements that were within the first 4 years of licensure, we had to earn an additional 12 credits, graduate credits, so that our education level would be the same as the National Board of Certified Counselors. And we had 2 years initially to get that, and then we would have 20 hours of CEUs every two years after that, I believe. Or was it 20 every year? Then in, I believe it was 2005, the board decided that it would be better to allow us 4 years to get the 12 graduate credits because of the cost and time involved and so forth, and that's when the statute was changed to allow 4 years. And at that time, there were still no CEU requirements until the graduate credits were earned. Then apparently in 2006, and it wasn't posted until 2007, a rule was established that put the additional 40 CEU hours in requirement in addition to the graduate credits. However, that was in the rules, and that was not publicized. When the statute was changed to allow us 4 years rather than 2 years, we got a huge packet and had the original statute plus the new statute plus point-by-point comparison of what difference it made, you know, to us as licensed professional counselors. However, when the rule was put in, there was no information put out about that. Even the people at the graduate schools that counsel potential counselors as to what their educational requirements are didn't know about this. When I came up to my third renewal, then at the end of my first 4 year period, I turned my renewal in. I had my 12 additional graduate credits, you know, that I, you know, obviously paid for and spent a lot of time in. And my renewal was rejected because I didn't have the 40 CEU hours. And I couldn't find in the statute still where there was that requirement. Then I was led to read the rules. The rule itself wasn't even published until I was already done with 3 years of that four-year period. So even if it had been publicized, which it wasn't, I would have had a year to get 4 years' worth of CEUs in. What I was told that I could do was to ask for a variance that would give me 6 months and possibly up to a year to make up those 40 CEUs. This would be during the same two-year period that I would be trying to amass more CEUs for my next renewal period. So effectively, I was looking at having to get 80 CEUs in a matter of 2 years. Not only in terms of time, which is exorbitant, I can take my two-week vacation and sit in CEUs, but it's also very expensive, especially after having invested an additional 12 graduate-level credits. Then when I started looking to see how many people may have been caught the same as I had, I found that I certainly was not the only one who was caught in this also, but several who had just not shown up again on the renewal figures, to where 70% of those who were licensed during the year that I was licensed were no longer licensed, which seems to be a rather exorbitant rate of attrition. And taking in, you know, the new licenses and so forth. So this is why I contacted
Representative Simon. Your bill would cover all those individuals who were in a similar situation that wants to come back,
correct,
into the profession as well.
In my year,
right?
Me.
Just in the 1 year. That's right. Nothing further than that. And Mr. Chair, I know you have a full agenda. I just wanted to say that I want to thank you personally for your patience and your intervention, I might even say, over the interim. As you know, we all met, and Ms. Peruschek as well. We really appreciate that. We were just informed in the last day or so that the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy is actually opposed to this bill. We didn't know that. We had been advised previous to that that they wouldn't have any problem with this bill. So we're now in the situation where we have been belatedly informed of this apparent about face. So I assume we're going to be hearing from them in a second.
Good timing. I know that there's some individual folks from the board would like to testify on this as well. You may go up to the podium and give your name for the record and proceed. All three of you don't have to testify if you don't need to. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Rexigal. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. And it is time for me to fall on my sword just a little bit. It's last fall I did speak with Representative Town, Representative Simon, about the situation. And as I recall in my meeting notes from a meeting last December, we discussed that a bill could be drafted specific to an individual to reinstate a license without completing CE. However, at that time, while I personally don't have a problem with individual bills, I did say I could not speak for the board's legislative committee. Following that, the bill came out in draft form. Our committee, legislative committee, met to discuss that, and the legislative committee is opposed to the bill. And I will make a few corrections to some of the testimony that you did hear. I did look back in the records regarding CE notice, and in a rulemaking notice dated December 19th, 2005, Ms. Garwick Foley was on the mailing list and did receive this notice. It clearly stated that LPCs had 4 years to complete their graduate credits. However, another numbered item said, in addition to completing requisite graduate coursework, each licensee is also required to complete a minimum of 40 hours of continuing education activities in the first 4 years of licensure. Those rules went through the rulemaking process. They were in the state register. The expedited CE rules became effective September 12, 2006, which is 2 years prior to the time she was to report. So just as a correction about the notice that was received.
Ms. Ritzel, do you know how many people did not renew their license due to the new rulemaking, or you don't have that number? Or
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I did look at some statistics. We don't track reasons why people terminate, allow their licenses to be terminated. However, I can tell you, since the board's, well, since the board first licensed people, the first licenses were issued June 1st of 2004. According to our records, 60 licenses have been administratively terminated for non-renewal, which is Ms. Garwick Foley's license would be one of them. And 89 licenses were voluntarily terminated. In other words, at the time of renewal, the licensee elected not to renew. So 150. But of those, there's no way to know. It could be 2008 people.
Sure.
You know, so no analysis has been done of the actual number.
Representative Abler?
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I've known about this board for a long time because I helped write the bill that got it going. And this, the LPCs and LPCCs are just the finest group of counselors and clinical counselors that you could find. There was a great need for a mid-level credential. It was, they've had their challenges. They've had to take in alcohol and drug counselors and the creating a board. There's been, they've had, people were shooting at them almost literally as some of this stuff got off the ground. And every time you have a new board, sometimes there are startup challenges. And Ms. Rexingle has been a stellar director of her board, and she's has a wonderful committee that she works with. And just, I haven't had a chance to talk to you about this, but please respect what I'm saying about your board and what I'm going to say now. Is in a startup board, sometimes you have to make exceptions to the rules, even though it's painful. And I'm going to suggest that we pass this bill tonight. And the beauty is, to the executive directors, you can go home and blame us. See, you tried. And you make your statement. And this bill might need some work. And but I think that in meeting a number of the women and men who were the founders of this, that brought this out of nothing into something, I got a feeling for what they're trying to accomplish. And I got to know some of their hearts and all this. And so we didn't want to lose any of them. And if there's a person who got caught up in a listserv that maybe they didn't read, I have 400 unopened emails right now in my thing, no lie, probably 420 by now since I haven't been there for a while. And I've missed some messages that I was hoping I would have got. And so it's at least my vote and the recommendation of this member to the committee that we try to help this process along. And so I think what you'll get from, if, I don't know if, what the votes are, but I know for me, my urging is that you find a way to accommodate whatever group of people you need to accommodate in the beginning. In 2015 and 2020, the people graduate, they know the rules. My chiropractic board will not accommodate me this way. It's been around a long time. I was tested in the state board on the rules and jurisprudence, and I'm supposed to know them. But in this new kind of a thing, I hope that, that we can help both the board as they keep the spirit of their founding alive and serving their licensees and in serving the people that need the service that this licensee, in particular, and other ones who have been carved out, might not get. So I hope we vote for this tonight.
Members, I know that in the past we have done similar legislation for individuals as well who either got caught in or got left behind in the past. And so this is not anything new that the legislature has done. So any questions, Rep. Sunrud?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, if this does go forward, how will you inform the people, the other people that this bill may also impact? Because this is not really just to the individuals, other people in your class, as I understand it.
Ms. Ritzadon?
Rep. Sunrud, I guess we haven't examined that issue fully, and unfortunately, our staff is so small, and we're so challenged with all the other regulatory duties that we have that, you know, if it's a legal priority, I'm going to have to do it. But I haven't formulated how I might do that.
Well, at least one of them will be well-informed. Representative Abler?
Just as a procedural thing, this bill has to go to the full health committee, which is not usually acted on there, but it has to then go to the floor. And I think that there's plenty of time for the author and the board to have a conversation, if need be, about something. And, you know, the board does have some kind of a, the board has no duty in this to inform anybody, just so you know. And you might put it in your newsletter that comes out after what session was, and like news, and maybe you could, by then you'll have a way to say it that you can stand, and maybe by then you'll work something out that's even modified, so.
Yeah. I also recommend that the board continue to work with Representative Simon to see if we could resolve this before it gets to the floor. So, okay. Seeing no more testimony or questions from the member, I renew my motion that House File 3212 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee of Health Care and Human Services Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Okay, you're on your way.
Thank you.
Representative Kath. House File 3070. I will move this bill to have it before us so we could have a discussion on it. Representative Kath?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you very much for allowing me to be here tonight and to have a hearing on this bill. Very important bill to me, not because it is about me, it's because it's about my service, and that is a service to a constituent and her family, and specifically two of her sons, who had a very negative experience when it came to a home health aide. And specifically looking at the situations that her family faced, we are trying to be proactive and try and create some changes that will help others across the state that face this situation. First off, this bill is a starting point. It's a recognition that we do need to do something with home health aides, how it is that they are promoted throughout the state, and specifically how they are trained. And so the bill does just a few things, and I'll go through that and then allow Ms. Bowers to give you a little testimony about her situation and why she hopes this can move forward. First off, the bill looks at the rights of a person who is receiving home care services to understand the continuing education and the process by which that home health aide is continuing their education. And right now, you are not privy to that information other than through maybe conversations with the home health aide, but that information is relevant, and it's very important to the client to understand what is the training of this individual and where are they going with that. Second thing is to say that in the standards that are before us, to make sure that our home health aides, as a component of their training, have an ethics process, as well as have some ethical training in their continuing education units. And for myself, the important aspect of that is, and I'm sure that Ms. Bauer will be able to testify to that, is that through ethics training, we can alleviate some of these problems. We can be proactive than always reactive to the scenarios that we see on the news. And finally, then, requiring home care providers to establish some employee drug and alcohol testing policies and procedures, again, as a proactive measure to prevent any unnecessary consequences through their services. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Ms. Bauer, who would like to give you a little bit about her story and specifically her sons, Alex and Levi.
Ms. Bowers, just state your name for the record and you may proceed.
My name is Beth Bauer. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for allowing me to speak. I have two children who have trachs and are in ventilators and have feeding tubes, and they are in wheelchairs and they require 24-hour care. And because of that, we have home health aides in our home. And we've had wonderful experiences. There's many wonderful home health aides out there. But this particular one kind of snowed us for a very long time and pretty much shocked the entire staff into what ended up happening. My oldest son, Alex, had gone to the hospital to have spine surgery. He had scoliosis and he had two rods put in his spine. Unfortunately, the rods punctured his lung four times, and they sewed my son up and sent him home. And I knew something more was wrong, took him to another hospital where thankfully they were able to save him. And he came home a very sick young man still. And so at first we didn't figure out what was going on. We just thought he wasn't recovering from his surgery. And in fact, we discovered later this home health aide was starving our son at night. Our children have feeding tubes that run 24 hours a day on a slow drip. So if you cut out one third of their calories, that's a lot. and that's what was happening. And like I say, we didn't catch it right away because he was very ill, and we just thought he was not doing well from his surgery still. So this proceeded on, we believe it started in June of 2008, and finally by the time we discovered for sure what was going on, it was October. And we believe it was kind of a hit and miss in the beginning. Sometimes she fed him, sometimes she didn't. But it was when our other son, who'd been extremely stable, started to lose weight. My husband and I, we always calculated all their meds and all their feedings, and we sat down and looked at this and said, there's just no way that they could be losing weight on this. There's just no way. So we knew right away we had a problem, and because we spend a lot of time with our children, we knew it had to be the night shift. So we thought, well, perhaps the woman is sleeping, and she maybe isn't sleeping at home well, and so she's falling asleep on the job, and we will catch her sleeping, and we'll talk to her, and it will be fine. And we got up at night to check on her and found out she wasn't sleeping. She was watching movies and eating herself and not feeding our children. So we hid video cameras because I'd had a past experience with a nurse who had done this to my children when they were very little, and she was not prosecuted. And so I knew I had to get evidence. And so we hid a camera, and after one night of discovering that there were things that shouldn't have been going on, we hid more cameras. And not only did we discover that she wasn't feeding them, she wasn't giving their medications, she wasn't giving them their lung nebulizer treatments, and the very last two nights that she worked was some very inappropriate self-sexual things going on, and then also her last night that she worked, she had a man in the house and had sex with him. She left the house to smoke. And by leaving the house and shutting the doors, you cannot hear the alarms for my children's ventilator. They could have died, and thankfully they did not. And the pictures, if you can see the progression of my son being starved, and amazingly enough, Alex and Levi are both A students, and he maintained his A's being that starved. And we believe he nearly died. He actually said to me about a month before we discovered what was going on, he said, Mom, I think I'm going to die. And I had been having that feeling as well, and I said, do you know what's going on? Because we'd been taking him to the doctor, his heart was beating 180 beats a minute, and we just didn't know what was wrong. No one could figure it out. And he said, no, I don't. And we even went so far as he requested to make his own funeral arrangements. And I believe if we hadn't figured it out, he would have died. And
Ms. Bowers, what is the home health aide for individual that I assume there is... She's not working for you anymore.
No. I took a blank tape out and confronted her, you know, that I had taped her and got her confession on some more tape. And then I forwarded everything to the Office of Monitoring and Health Compliance.
Has anything happened to her?
Yes. They took her licensing away. But in the meantime, it took them 7 months to go through that process, apparently. And in the meantime, she was working in another home with four children. And taking care of children with special needs. She is no longer doing that, and she is being prosecuted by our county attorney, but that's a whole other piece that we hope to address maybe next year because there's a whole fiscal note with it. But sure. Just instead of that being a misdemeanor where they can only charge her with a year for starving my children for 4 months, to make that a stronger thing in the future, and that's not something we're doing now, but something we hope to accomplish maybe next year.
All right.
To deter people from doing this. You know, I'm not looking to send people to jail and not looking to do bad things to people. I want to stop the people that are doing these things to people that are vulnerable, and children specifically.
All right.
Mr. Chair and members, you know, that's really where the bill is headed, is trying to do that proactive approach of looking at ethics training and trying to make sure that we can do something to kind of move this ahead and ensure this doesn't happen to anyone else.
We do have... Ms. Winkleman from the, I believe, department, want to touch base on this? State your name for the record and your position. You may proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director in the Division of Compliance Monitoring with the State Health Department. And Representative Kath asked me to come tonight and tell you some of our also proactive activities to try and deal with some of the issues that Ms. Bauer has had to deal with. We have, through our or was authorized in 2007, a home care regulatory work group to look at all sorts of things dealing with the, how we're licensing home health care in Minnesota. Streamlining licensure is our big ticket item, and that's part of our goal for 2011. And as part of that, really, I would say that pretty much everything's on the table. We're looking at streamlining the licensure because right now we have four licenses, and it's kind of a complicated system. But along that way, we're looking at devising a set of licensing standards that are based on the level of skill needed for the care. And I think that Ms. Bauer really told a very heart-wrenching tale about what she experienced, and certainly her son's care needs are quite high. And so those are exactly the types of issues that we're looking at. I think that when we spoke to Representative Kath earlier about these issues, it was also along the lines of boundaries, and that's also on the table. But I think that hearing your tale is also a good way or a reason for us to also look at contacting Ms. Bauer later and also getting some more information about how she can feed into this work group. To get back to more of the work group activities, we have pretty much every side to the issue at the table. We have consumer organizations and provider organizations and regulators as well. And we're also always looking for ways of tapping into consumers' stories and anything that we can do to make our final product the best product possible. So I just wanted to come today and share with you the ongoing activities that we have to hopefully address issues that Ms. Bauer has experienced and many others, too.
Okay. Any questions for the testifier? I've been informed that... Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Winkleman, I don't think this is to the point of the bill, but since it was mentioned as part of the story, the delay in time between the original complaint and when the 7 months that was mentioned about until the person was stripped of their license... I would hope that, I think several of us seemed alarmed when we heard that, that someone could be temporarily restricted from working with other children or families until the investigation was completed and a decision was made on their license. In this kind of situation, when we have very high-risk people, could you share with us any further as to whether or not we currently have that capacity in the statute or do not, and whether your working group is also addressing that issue?
Ms. Winkleman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn. You raise a really good point, an important one, and one that we're also looking at. There are many kinds of enforcement gaps and time periods that we want to close because, obviously, if we have a caregiver who's giving substandard care, we want to deal with it now rather than later. The way our licensing structure currently goes, we have these four license types. And the employees within it, one of which is the home health care aide, we can take action against the licensee, but that's the employer. So we really need a different way of approaching each individual. And I'm sorry I wasn't privy to all of the facts, so I wasn't able to find out from our Office of Health Facility Complaints exactly about this matter before us. But it does take a certain amount of time to investigate these things. So, but I think you're right. I think that we're absolutely looking for ways of shortening that time and figuring out a better way of handling it.
Okay. I've been informed that Mr. Goodnow, former commissioner, is want to say a couple words. You know the routine.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Goodnow here representing the Minnesota Home Care Association. And although we have currently some concerns about the way the bill is currently drafted, we as an association do not want to see what happened to Ms. Bauer's kids to happen to anybody else. And so we're committed to working with Representative Kath and Ms. Bauer's and trying to come up with a solution that will solve those problems and those concerns. But we just want to be on the record letting you know that.
Thank you. Representative Kath, I want to... thank you for bringing this to the committee's attention. It looks like the department and the stakeholders group are working on this issue alongside of what you're doing. And I encourage Ms. Bauer to be part to take an active role and be part of this. So for that, we're going to table the bill. Representative Norton, table the bill tonight for now. So
I'd love to take a vote on it.
So the bill has been tabled. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Or laid over, I'm sorry. Laid over. We have Representative Norton, House File 2897.
Not table, but laid over. Laid over on the table.
I didn't hear that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton, go ahead.
I'd like to move House File 2897 to be passed, and I believe it has to probably go to health care policy.
Yes. Representative Norton moves that House File 2897 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Health Care and Human Services Policy. And I believe Representative Norton has a DE one.
I don't believe it's a delete all, is it?
Yeah.
It's a delete all? Okay. I thought it was an addition.
Representative Norton moves the DE one to put the bill in the shape that the author wants.
Yes.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Motion carries. Representative Norton, the bill in the shape that you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I bring forward a bill that is making some modifications to the current licensure for psychologists in the state of Minnesota. We are not aware of any opposition, and so hopefully this will be short and sweet. I'll just give you a couple points about what's in the bill, and then if you have questions, we have another testifier here, and between the two of us, hopefully we can answer any of those. The bill will provide reciprocity for psychologists licensed in another jurisdiction as they apply for full licensure in the state of Minnesota. So this allows individuals who are licensed in another state, when they come here to apply for licensure in this state, to continue practicing. And I can tell you, having gone through this from personal experience, it's very difficult in the state of Minnesota. When you don't have the reciprocity, you end up being perhaps unemployed or underemployed for the length of time it takes to get the license, which can be upwards of 2 years. It extends the length of guest licensures from 30 days to 9 months, and this allows for professionals who might be here on a sabbatical or supervising students to be able to have their practice and be a licensed psychologist during the time of their tenure in the state. It provides language to administer a volunteer license. This license has been in statute, but psychologists weren't able to access it because there was no information on how to administer the fees or continuing education. That's outlined in the D1 that we brought forward. It redefines the makeup of the Board of Psychology, as if some of you will remember, although the ones that were here then have left the table. It used to be you needed a master's degree, or the requirement was for a master's degree. Now it is for a PhD for psychology, and so the makeup of the board will change from a master's level psychologist to a PhD level psychologist. And then the bill also allows psychologists to be the last reviewer of appeals for denial of services by health plans. Psychologists could review appeals, but for all but psychiatrists, who explicitly would be reviewed by other psychologists. Currently, psychiatrists complete the final review for all but psychologists. This is not cost effective and requires an extra step in the review process, and the Council of Health Plans has reviewed this and supports that change. So I think with that, I would ask the other testifier to make comments, and then I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Ms. Stark, state your name for the record. You may proceed.
Okay. My name is Dr. Tricia Stark, and I'm a licensed psychologist and director of professional affairs for the Minnesota Psychological Association. I don't know that I have a lot to add. This bill basically cleans up some licensure things. As Representative Norton said, it allows psychologists to be licensed on a temporary basis when they move to this jurisdiction if they've been licensed in another jurisdiction. It extends the period of time for guest licensure. It allows us to implement volunteer license. This is really important to me. We have some members who have volunteered for the Red Cross for a number of years, and they're now retired, and they can, because they don't have a license, and they've tried to get the volunteer license.
Now, Stark, just remember, you have no opposition.
Okay. Okay. Well, I guess I don't have
Mr.
anything.
Mr. Chair, is
additional.
That yet?
Yes.
I guess I don't have anything additional to say then.
Very good. Are there any oppositions from the audience who want to testify against this bill? Okay, I don't see any. Any questions from the members? I don't see any. All right. Representative Norton renews her motion that House File 2897 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Health Care and Human Services Policy. All those in favor as amended, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Thank you.
Shouldn't they all be that easy, Mr. Chair?
Just wait. We got a couple more to go.
Thank you so much.
Representative Root. Representative Root moves House File 3272, recommended pass and referred to the Committee Health and Human Services Policy. Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And Mr. Chair, I do have a very small oral amendment, if I may.
Go ahead.
On line 2.24, after the comma, strike end reproductive, and on 2.25, strike alternatives.
Okay, Representative Rue moves the oral amendment on 2.24, end reproductive, and on 2.25, alternatives, to put the bill in the shape that the author wants. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay, motion carries. Okay, the bill's in the shape that you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3272 is a bill to license genetic counselors. This bill was brought to me by genetic counselors. With the mapping of the human genome, genetic testing is becoming increasingly more common, both inside the confines of healthcare facilities and in the comfort of your own home. In fact, Mr. Chair, I think it was in your district the other day, and I saw a big billboard for paternity testing that you could purchase, I think, at Walgreens. So it's over the counter. There are TV shows now that talk about movie stars who are getting their DNA tested, and we're learning the results on TV. So it's becoming increasingly more common. And as we seek to provide quality health care and reduce costs, and as genetics play an increasingly more visible role in health care, it's critical that people are counseled and tested appropriately and educated regarding the possible implications for their health. Currently, 6 states are licensing genetic counselors. 20 states are in the process of working on that, of licensing. And with that, Mr. Chair, and the remaining members, I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers, if I may.
Ms. Power?
Thank you, Representative Rood. Chairman Tao, distinguished members, I'm Amy Powers, and I'm a certified genetic counselor from Roseville, Minnesota, and I work at the University of Minnesota Medical Center, Fairview. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Genetic Counselor Association and chair of the Social Policy Committee. On behalf of the Minnesota Genetic Counselors, we thank Representative Rood for introducing HF 3272. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of this important legislation that would provide licensure for certified genetic counselors in Minnesota. Just to provide a little bit of background, genetic counselors are healthcare providers with significant training and expertise in genetics and psychosocial counseling obtained through a 2-year master's level program. Most enter the field from a variety of disciplines, including biology, genetics, nursing, and psychology. There are 32 accredited training programs in the United States, including a program housed at the University of Minnesota for the last 20 years. Genetic counselors are part of a healthcare team providing information and support to individuals and families concerned with genetic disorders. Genetic counselors collect and interpret family and medical histories, identify individuals and families at risk, explain inheritance and natural history, quantify chance for occurrence and reoccurrence, review available testing options, and discuss management, prevention, and research opportunities. They also serve as patient advocates and refer individuals and families to community or state support services as appropriate. Genetic counselors are employed in a wide range of clinical care, academic, laboratory, research, and biotechnology settings. Within Minnesota, there are approximately 65 genetic counselors, most of whom provide direct patient care. HF 3272 is extremely important, as this bill would help protect the public from potential harms that may result from this occupation remaining unregulated. Harm caused by untrained individuals attempting to provide genetic counseling includes inappropriately undertaking costly genetic testing, misinformation regarding genetic risk or lack of risk, misunderstanding of the implications of genetic information such as family history of test results, which can lead to unnecessary medical treatment or surgery, incorrect screening and development of preventable diseases, irreversible management decisions, and avoidable fear, anxiety, and guilt. As there are 3,000 to 4,000 hereditary diseases and conditions, and we are learning of genetic contributions to common diseases, providers without specific genetics training are understandably using genetics in their practices. Unfortunately, surveys have shown that only 25% of non-genetics physicians rate themselves as having good to excellent knowledge of genetics. Approximately 30% of non-genetics healthcare providers misinterpreted the results of genetic testing that they ordered on their patients. Involvement of genetic counselors in general patient care can aid in alleviating many of these knowledge gaps and ensure high-quality genetic counseling services. Genetic testing is now being marketed directly to consumers. These consumers will inevitably have questions or concerns about these results and may need the expertise of qualified genetics professionals. I believe that this is becoming clear to the medical community and even insurance companies. This is best demonstrated by a recent policy initiative intended to support clinical best practices and to improve access and awareness for genetic tests that Medica, a large Minnesota health insurance company, implemented this past Monday. In Medica's words, the genetic counseling initiative is designed to provide appropriate testing for Medica members who may be at risk for diseases with known inheritance patterns, such as some colorectal or breast cancers. As a result, these patients will receive necessary follow-up care, at the same time helping to prevent unnecessary care and undue anxiety. There's also a Minnesota statute in place which recommends genetic counseling as part of the genetic testing process, and yet there is not any provision in place to describe who is qualified to provide such services. We urge you to enact this legislation as it would establish requirements for the licensure of genetic counselors, ensuring minimum standards for individuals in terms of academic achievement, clinical experience, and skills necessary to deliver high-quality genetic counseling services. Currently in Minnesota, there are no legal standards for who can represent themselves as genetic counselors. As the field of medical genetics grows, there is and will continue to be a need to provide the citizens of Minnesota with accurate information regarding their genetic risks and results of genetic tests. At present, there is no mechanism that assures citizens that the individual who is providing this information is qualified to do so. Additionally, there is no way for employers to assure they are hiring individuals who have the appropriate training and education to provide genetic counseling services, or that would prohibit unskilled individuals from using the title of genetic counselor. This legislation, again, would give the public a mechanism to identify qualified providers of genetic counseling services. In conclusion, the Minnesota Genetic Counselors Association is hopeful that the committee will work with Representative Rood to enact genetic counseling licensure that will ensure the people of Minnesota receive quality genetic counselor services. We believe the people of Minnesota will be well served, and we thank the chairman and this committee for your attention on this important issue.
Thank you. We also have on the list Ms.
Aarons.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, and Ms. Berry as well. Dr. Berry, and Ms. State your name for the record, and you may proceed.
Yes. My name is Mary Aarons.
Aarons.
Honorable Chair and committee members, thank you very much for this invitation to speak to you today regarding the Genetic Counselor's License, HF3272. I'm a certified genetic counselor currently employed as the program manager for the genetic counseling program at Fairview Health Services in the Twin Cities. I also work at the University of Minnesota Genetic Counseling Graduate Program as the Associate Director for Clinical Training with graduate students. Genetic counseling is really a young profession. It's only about 35 years old. I feel fortunate to have been a genetic counselor for over 20 of those years, watching the profession grow in size and respect among healthcare providers nation and statewide. For many years, I've been involved in our national organization, the National Society of Genetic Counselors, and I'm also a founding member of the Minnesota Genetic Counseling Association. My clinical experience involves seeing patients both in pediatric and adult clinics. Currently, most of the patients I see in clinic are concerned about the possibility of having a gene associated with cancer. For example, it's not unusual for me to see women in their 40s recently diagnosed with breast cancer. One of the questions that frequently is asked by my patients is, how will this diagnosis affect the risk of cancer in my relatives? More specifically, they ask, how does this cancer diagnosis affect my sisters and my teenage daughter? As a genetic counselor, it's my job to evaluate my patient's family history for hereditary cancer. Without effective family history evaluation, which is what we do as genetic counselors, genetic risk can be underestimated. Hereditary cancer is one example where relatives of a patient are also at risk for being a carrier or having the condition. Identifying who in the family truly is affected by the genetic information provides the opportunity to identify the relatives at increased risk who need that screening that's extra and their treatment. The desired effect of the screening is to decrease the chance of the disease in the family. Identifying families who did not inherit that increased risk in the family eliminates the need for expensive clinical follow-up. Genetic counselors provide services that increase the quality and cost effectiveness. We ensure that tests are utilized appropriately. Many health care providers often request unnecessary genetic testing or incorrect tests, increasing the cost of health care for the consumer. To illustrate this point, I'd like to describe a situation that we had in our clinic. A few months ago, I saw a patient to discuss the results of a cancer genetic test that had been ordered at another clinic. The original test request from that clinic was for a $4,000 test. Based on the family history, the patient actually needed a genetic test that cost only $400. With the intervention of the genetic counselor, eventually the correct test was ordered. The patient should have had a result in 3 weeks. Instead, it took over 6 weeks because of the miscommunication and confusing test request received by the lab that did the test. I would like to conclude with a quote from a colleague. Genetic counseling gives people information about their genetic health. I think this statement clearly summarizes what we do with our expertise as genetic counselors. I strongly encourage you to consider this bill as we move forward to ensure that your constituents in Minnesota have quality genetic counseling services available to everyone. Thank you very much.
Dr. Berry.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today about licensing genetic counselors. My name is Susan Berry. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota. I'm the director of the Division of Genetics and Metabolism in the Department of Pediatrics. So as a professional, I'm certified in what is also a relatively new specialty of medical genetics, that as well as being a board-certified pediatrician. What this means is I'm a doctor, a physician, who's had specialty training in the diagnosis and management of persons who have genetic diseases. And I have the honor also to be the medical director for the Genetic Counseling Training Program at the University of Minnesota. The matter before you today concerns that of what you've heard described as a relatively new profession, that of genetic counseling. Genetic counselors are absolutely essential to the provision of care in today's healthcare environment. Increasingly, physicians and other healthcare practitioners are called upon to assess and manage conditions with inherited or genetic predispositions. And genetic counselors are the professionals trained to provide comprehensive information to families and ensure appropriate testing is accomplished. Like other healthcare professionals, they have to undergo rigorous training to make sure they have the knowledge base and expertise to fulfill their professional commitment. This is typically a master's degree, persons who undergo that training are eligible for certification by the American Board of Genetic Counseling. As a medical genetics physician, I work in teamwork with genetic counseling professions. My job on the team is diagnosis and management, but I work with the genetic counselor to plan appropriate testing. In our partnership, it's the genetic counselor's job to make sure that the family is fully informed about the implications of the testing, the nature of the information that will provide for their health, and what the information means for consideration for reproduction and for other family members. Other physicians and providers beyond geneticists need benefit from consultation with genetic counselors. The counselor can provide appropriate advice about complex testing, as Mary has told you about, and provide good information for families. They're also trained to provide support for families as each family arrives at decisions about their genetic information. I thought it was important to extend my strongest support for licensure for these essential healthcare professionals. As a new profession, it's not always easy to make sure that even healthcare providers know about genetic counseling. Currently, there's no uniform expectation for training or levels of expertise for those referring to themselves as genetic counselors. And I believe that licensure would provide a means for assuring quality and provision of these essential services. So I urge your favorable consideration.
Thank you. Ms. Aaron, I have a question. I know you told me outside in the hallway, just for the record, how many genetic counselors are in Minnesota?
There's
65.
There's about 65 in the state of Minnesota. There's close to 2,000 in the United States.
Okay. There are questions from members? Rep. Simban?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple questions. When you say 65, is that certified genetic counselors? Or is there a registry of all genetic counselors?
When we say 65, they're either certified or they're eligible to be certified. So genetic counselors who graduate, the exam is only given every year. So they're either eligible or certified.
I assume certified at what, some board or a national level?
Yes, at the national level, through the American Board of Genetic Counseling.
Right. Representative?
Thank you. Then if all of these folks are certified or on their way to being certified, then how much genetic counseling is being done in the state by anyone who's not on one of those two paths, certified or on the way of being certified? And what portion of the market does that represent, if it exists at all?
Ms. Aarons or Ms. Power? Ms. Power, if you want to, you could just come up to the podium. State your name for the record.
Sure. My name is Amy Powers. And so your question was how many people within the state are practicing genetic counseling without having certification or eligible for certification. To my knowledge, there's not a specific individual that's practicing within the state under that title. However, it's really difficult to say because we don't really have a good way of monitoring that information.
Follow-up, Rep. Simban?
Well, I'm trying to get at the heart of why you're here, in the sense that going from certification to licensing usually requires, generally speaking, in this committee, that there are non-certified people engaged in this activity who you believe should not be because they are at some, their activity is providing some risk to the public for health or safety, and therefore you're trying to have a strict licensure so that only those people with that licensure can be practice this profession at all. So it's unclear to me that anyone is hiring people that are non-certified or on their way to being certified, or that they even exist, and therefore I'm not sure of the problem existing. And so I'm trying to ascertain that. Okay.
So I would say, you know, I understand your concern that it hasn't happened to date, to our knowledge. However, with the advent of the extreme explosion of genetic testing and the fact that it's becoming much more readily available, we're trying to foresee some of the concerns that could arise. In addition, we do know of situations of harm where inappropriate genetic tests have been ordered by individuals who have not utilize genetic counselors or don't have genetics training. And so what we're doing by trying to do by becoming licensed is really establish a good scope of practice and integrate ourselves fully into the healthcare system, which would enable easier access to our services to all patients.
Representative Bunn, then we'll go to Representative Norton.
Well, last comment then on that. We have in statute in 214.02 a list of questions, and I don't know if you've filled those out or not. I would need that before moving something like this forward. But if you have, I think that if reading the statute, you'll understand that we typically need more than it might happen someday, you know, if such and such was to occur. And in fact, the bar is that we need to see evidence that there's been harm done, or that it's very likely to have been done, and some sort of evidence for that to go from certain, you know, to a higher level of regulation. So
okay.
I have utmost respect for your profession and your practice, but we would, and I understand this is the first time we've experienced this discussion at the Capitol, so I'm really thankful that you're here and that Representative Rood has brought it to us so we can begin learning about, you know, further about this and what the changes in this area. But we would need a little more work done on those issues, I think, at least from my perspective.
Ms. Aaron?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm Mary Ahrens. I just wanted to add a personal experience that I've had with a patient who went through using some direct-to-consumer testing.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a misinterpretation, and this patient actually suffered emotional and mm-hmm. financial harm as a result of that, and genetic counseling was not provided.
Mm-hmm.
She went to her doctor, who at that point could not interpret the results for her, and actually ended up seeing me after 3 months of going mm-hmm. through this turmoil. So mm-hmm. that's an which I foresee, again, I think we're trying to be proactive, and I see that as an issue coming up in the future as more and more direct-to-consumer mm-hmm. testing is, as we said, up on the billboards in mm-hmm. St. Paul. So mm-hmm. that's another issue.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, just as an aside, I have legislation regarding the direct-to-consumer marketing tested because those do not fall under CLIA,
yeah.
so they are not regulated at all in our state. And we are... Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have some of the same questions and concerns that Representative Rood did. I have the utmost respect, as Representative Bunn mentioned, and have actually been through genetic testing myself 30 years ago when it was brand new. So I know what it's like, and I know what it's like to wait for results and need an appropriate person to talk to. So I very much appreciate what you're here for. I do think part of the problem we've identified is that there is this direct-to-consumer issue, and there's also the issue of easy access to these new, you know, tests, and that if there's not a way to mandate that a person require counseling if you have the test, we're not going to really get at the problem that you're trying to get to. So I suggest you keep moving ahead with what you're doing, because I do agree with you that down the line, I think there will be more and more need for genetic testing as we move forward with the genomics projects that are across the country now, Mayo Clinic and everywhere else. But I really think part of the issue is, as was mentioned before, when you have those box tests or the ones you see on the billboard, you get your results back, and there's no requirement that you see a counselor, so you can inappropriately interpret the test yourself, or as you pointed out, go to a doctor who can't. And unless we somehow mandate that if you have one of those tests done, there's that counseling component to it, we're still not going to get the people that need to talk to you to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope as we move forward, we can consider that and see if we can't find some creative ways to address that need too. But I really thank you for being here. This is important, and I'm glad you're bringing the issue to our attention.
Thank you. Representative Rood, you have the last word.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members for taking the time to listen to this. I think we all agree that we have a lot of respect for the genetic counselors. It's been really a pleasure to work with them. Just a couple of comments. They are in the process. They do they have filled out the questions, I think, maybe you even have you maybe have a copy of them with you. Those were distributed.
No,
but there is
right
a plan
here
to bring that forward to the council and health boards, and they have 2 weeks from the time when the legislation is introduced, so it hasn't been 2 weeks yet, so we're doing okay. And the other thing, I think, just in keeping in mind that these tests are available, again, in the clinic and direct-to-consumer market, and I think ultimately we'll be hearing probably more and more from health plans that are deciding they're not going to pay for a particular test because it was ordered inappropriately. So it's just these guys are kind of cutting edge. You know, they may be a little ahead of their time in some ways, but I think it was an important hearing to have, and thank you for your indulgence tonight.
Thank you, Representative Rood, for bringing this forward. Thank you, Representative Rood, for bringing this forward. I'm going to lay this bill over, and you know, we'll continue to have this discussion in the future. So thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We have Representative Bunn's gonna reconsider House File 677.
Yes, Representative.
And I think we have to vote on this. So Representative Bunn, the new chief author of House File 677, is reconsidering House File. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Okay, your bill is before us, alive and kicking. Representative Bunn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and appreciate your attention to this issue this evening. We took up this bill last year. I'm going to give a little history of this issue and this bill so we understand where we are and where we hope to go with this and why. And then I'm going to take you a little bit, walk you through what's contained in this bill as well. The history is that this was, and I don't know how far back I can, the history, our chair probably knows more, other people will come up to testify, I could maybe add to this, but the history in terms of the broad sweep of it is, first of all, who brought this idea and this bill to the legislature originally. And from my understanding, it really came from two distinct sources. One is our blood banks, the Red Cross and Memorial Blood Bank and others were interested in having a statewide licensure of body artists and so that they could change the current policy, which is currently anyone who's had a body art, have tattooing or piercing in the previous 12 months cannot give blood. In our state, because of the aging of our population, fewer and fewer people are eligible to give blood because more people have diseases and things that exclude them from giving blood. So our blood, to make sure for the future we have adequate supply of blood, they're looking to make sure those are who are of age and have a health status can be available to give blood. And we're finding culturally that more and more people have tattoos and various kinds of body art. Last week someone indicated to me, I don't know if it's true, but maybe some of our artists can support or correct this, boy, that possibly, you know, possibly one in four young people, teenagers, 20-somethings, have tattoos today. So it's a large number of people who do this, and therefore it does challenge the number of people who can give blood. So that was one impetus for this legislation or for this effort. The second is, in the past, there was a particular tattoo artist, I believe that was his background, who had worked with Senator Pretner Solon to advance this legislation, I think wanting to more thoroughly regulate his own industry. I understand he's kind of stepped out of this discussion at this point now for other personal reasons, and so is not involved, but we have many artists here this evening who will all be working with going forward to further refine this legislation. Last session, we voted this piece of legislation down in committee in the form before we amended it, because we're going to put the delete all on tonight, so we'll do that in just a moment. And that was done for a variety of reasons, but I can't speak for my colleagues. I can just speak for myself as to why I voted a no on it last year. I felt that the bill as it was presented as spectating was excessively regulatory, both in terms of the physical aspects of the environment of the establishment and also in the tracking and paperwork involved with the actual jewelry and other things like that. Also, it wasn't consistent in how it regulated across types of establishments, temporary versus permanent, or types of artist, regular versus guest, etc. And moreover, it had an apprentice system involved in the legislation, which I viewed as overly anti-competitive in terms of having current practitioners control the supply of anyone else into the industry.
Representative Bunn, yeah. Looks like you're moving to explaining the current DE. Why don't we move the DE?
Well,
and you could explain the DE and we could go.
Actually, I'd like to say a few more things, and then we'll move the DE, okay? just want to give this history. Over the interim, we were committed, I personally was committed to moving forward with trying to fix the issues that were involved last year so that we could address the blood supply issue and also have greater health and safety for those who have body art done in our state. As part of this effort, we asked MDH to do a report, the Department of Health to do a report on body art. Also, the Council of Health Boards was asked to do a report. MDH came back with that report in January 15th of this year, and the Council of Health Boards in December of this year. What has occurred to lead to the DE amendment that we're having before us here? in a moment, is that we took the information from those two reports, also information provided to me by one of the body tattoo artists who's been following this issue for a long time, Ms. Tanique Nolan,
yes.
The information from there, and also information from other states, and pulled all that together, had a meeting, and this didn't occur till last week, and so I apologize to all the involved, and we'll talk about that further in terms of the rapidity of this, but pulled that together with discussions with the health department to try to come up with a bill, an amendment that would be meet the needs of the safety for our blood supply in terms of not requiring the 12 months, at the same time being consistent across different types of establishments, artists, and temporary versus regular, and also not being overly burdensome regulatory-wise. So that was our goal, to focus on the health and safety aspects regards to legislation. So with that, it led to, just as of yesterday, the DE amendment that is before you. So I will move the DE1 amendment.
Okay, Rep. Bunn moves the DE1 in the shape that the author wants. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries. There was, as the author want is before us, explain the bill, and then
I want to, this is a little bit of a unique situation tonight with what we're doing here and the process forward. With faced with all that information last week coming together finally, we are faced with the choice of either not proceeding at all, because it's a complicated issue and there was a lot of new information that had come in, with simplifying, just pushing it back to the health department and saying, we'll just tell you to do rulemaking for the next couple of years and then come back to us, but would put off dealing with the blood supply issue for several years. And it would have a fiscal note on it as well if we did that. So why I decided to move forward is I looked at some legislation from other states that had been produced from rulemaking, and I thought the legislation in the other states was pretty not very good, actually, for a number of reasons. So I actually thought we could actually do better than what I saw produced from long periods of rulemaking if we put our heads to that task. So that's what why I decided to move forward. Rather than to incur that cost and have years of delay, that we would do our best to work with those involved in the health department and with the artists in the next few weeks and month and see if we can actually pull this together in a way that would work for us and address those issues. So that's the background, but it's important to understand. And in particular, the most important part to understand is the artists involved in these industries just saw this for the first time yesterday or this morning. And that couldn't be avoided given the timing of when this came together last week and the actually wasn't drafted until yesterday. And therefore, I fully anticipate to be working with all of you in the weeks ahead because this has several more committees to go through. And the action is going to be on the House side. You don't have to deal with both sides, at least here initially, to try to come to as best solution as we can on this. In terms of the bill itself, briefly, I know most of you won't be interested in all the technical detail, and you can ask questions, but also the artists in the room or the health department can give more detail if you would like to ask them. In particular, just to talk about the bill itself, first of all, it talks about what's included. So in subdivision one on the first page, we have body art defined. And partly as a result of the studies that were done over the interim, in particular the Department of Health, we have expanded what is included on this list. Other practices were uncovered or explored, and the advice from the health department, I am relying on the health department for this part of it and also for the health and safety issue, was expanded. We also have, as I indicated, had a broader definition of establishment. So establishment can be something that's actually, you know, a part of a home if it's structured in a certain way, a shop. It could even be in an expo if it meets certain other requirements or other kinds of things. But we want to be consistent about the health and safety features of them, but they can be in a variety of settings. It also, this legislation licensed both the establishment and also the individual artist technician. I explored whether or not that was necessary to do both. I explored licensing establishments only rather than also technicians. And as a result of long discussions with the health department, this one we concluded we had to do both. And so that's where this has ended up. So in the bill, at there is in 4.1, there are health and safety issues related to the establishment indicated, also kind of paperwork and documentation issues, and also inspection-related issues. Then on 6.13, we have issues regarding the licensure of the individual technician. And in particular, in this section, starting on 7.1, we start getting at the heart of partly what we were trying to do here, which was to require of the individual technician some experience and exposure in having to deal with the health and safety features. So starting on 7.3, for example, they have to have had some coursework on bloodborne pathogens, about prevention of disease transmission, infection control, those kinds of things, antiseptic techniques, etc. This is what was missing, at least in state law, prior to this. There are cities and localities that have extensive regulation for parts of this industry, and we will not be, but this is what we're now requiring statewide here. Since there's currently no schools, or at least the artist can correct me on this, but our study not necessarily schools for these activities, there may be need the development of new kinds of courses to meet this requirement, and we listed possible organizations here that would provide these courses for them to meet this kind of requirement. In the addition in this area, it talks about exceptions. Currently, there is, you know, piercing and tattooing and various kind of things being done within the scope of practice of different medical areas, and we explicitly exclude all of that so that there's no confusion in terms of what other medical, what medical practices can certainly do under their scope of practice. Then we have in Section 5, grounds for denial of licenses to individuals' establishments, emergency closure rules, those kinds of things. Section 6 addresses the issue of the entire establishment and the health and safety standards required of them. And then further on, we have the standards for how you actually perform the procedures or the perform the art and the health and safety and sanitation issues around those. So those are the key features of what is in here. As I said, our goal, I don't feel as a legislature myself, make decisions about the actual sanitation issues and types of machines and temperatures and all of that. That's the portion of this that I delegated to the health department with the inputs from other legislation and also based on their fieldwork, and also gave to them all the input I'd had from the tattoo artist community about those issues for them to come back to me with a final determination as to their best recommendation as to what was needed in those areas, and that is what was reflected in the bill. So there may be some disagreement over those things, but again, it's if there continues to be disagreement on those aspects, the health aspects, I would be having conversations with the health department and the artists in the room together over the next period of time to see if we can resolve those differences if they exist on that aspect of it. If there's differences that exist, as I expect there are in some of the other aspects, I know that parts of the industry actually wanted more regulation than this in certain aspects. Wanted more restrictions on age at which people can get these have tattooing or piercing done, and changed law on that. I raised those kinds of questions. The health department actually pushed back on that. For example, they did not want to restrict it to 18 and above. They did want to still have a parental consent for below that. It was their view, or they can speak to this if they like later, that they have to weigh kind of the issue of pushing activities underground versus having them above ground and allowing for consent at younger ages. And so that's where that came from, but we certainly could address that in the future if we wanted to go back to that. We did tighten consent a bit in the sense that now you have to have a notarized document, not just a form filled out. So someone can't just portray themselves as a parent anymore. It has to be a notarized document to give greater assurance that it's a parent or guardian that is attesting. And this usual things about not performing in terms of if there's certain contraindications with either medical conditions or if the individual's under the influence or something at the time that they are wanting to do this. And again, in closing, I want to state that this is intended to be a baseline for the state to protect the blood supply so that the Red Cross blood bank issues are addressed, and that our cities can still have more extensive regulation than this on either the health and safety or other features if they would like to or think it's best for their communities to do that to protect the public.
Good.
So,
very good. Very
thank
thorough.
Thank you for your patience.
We have Mr. Kaufman, and I believe, why don't we have Mr. Kaufman and Mr. Gorin come up and go at the same time. Representative Bunn has done a very, very thorough job of explaining the bill. And if you don't have anything to add to what Ms. Representative Bunn already stated, you don't have to. State your name for the record. You may proceed.
Thank you, Chairman, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Kaufman. I'm the CEO of the North Central Blood Services of the American Red Cross here in St. Paul. And I just want to state very briefly that the American Red Cross supports the statewide regulation of the tattoo and body art establishments and technicians because it can enhance the population of eligible donors, as Representative Bunn talked about. Without statewide regulation, people who receive tattoos or body art must wait 12 months before they're eligible to donate blood. Potential donors who have received a tattoo or body art in the past 12 months from a facility in a state that has no law or regulation without single-use needles or ink are deferred from donating blood for a period of 12 months due to an increased risk of disease transmission by facilities that reuse needles and or the ink. The American Red Cross follows the AABB, American Association of Blood Banks, standards for deferring persons who received a tattoo, body art, or piercing within the 12 months in an unregulated facility from donating blood. With the statewide regulation, which requires single-use needles and ink, sanitation, and bloodborne pathogen training, potential blood donors would not be deferred for 12 months. They would be eligible to donate blood immediately. Some counties do regulate tattoo establishments, as has been stated, but the current system is fragmented and does not meet the criteria to eliminate the 12-month deferral for blood donors throughout Minnesota, and that's a requirement by the AABB. Statewide regulation could enhance public health and safety while increasing the number of potential eligible blood donors and the supply of blood. And in conclusion, we believe the statewide regulation can have a positive effect on all residents of Minnesota who want to give blood for patients in need or who one day may need life-saving blood transfusions themselves. Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jed Gorlin, Medical Director, Memorial Blood Center. In 60 seconds or less, on October 30th, Star Tribune had an article, Carver County Town puts one-year ban on tattoo parlors. In the absence of state law, Watertown wants to protect its citizens. A tattoo artist, Dwayne Holt, stated, for every stand-up establishment, there are three or four guys working at home. Holt said, you wouldn't want to go to a plastic surgeon who works out of his garage. In response to that, Mr. Kaufman and I submitted a letter to the editor, which didn't actually get published, but it states, a majority of states in the nation license tattoo parlors to ensure single-use needles and inks in compliance with hygiene regulations. In states with statewide regulation, blood centers do not need to defer donors for 1 year following a tattoo. Once a donor is deferred, even temporarily, they are much less likely to return. This has particular impact when the donor is young. Therefore, I speak for Memorial Blood Centers, and we worked with the Red Cross and Mayo Blood Center to support a licensing bill that will help ensure safe and adequate blood supply for future generations. Time is up.
Mr. Gorin, that was 61 seconds. Anyway, I have a question. If this goes through, how many people are we expecting to see come and donate from this population?
We're not exactly sure, Mr. Chairman, but I will say that, as Representative Bunn had quoted, I heard on CCO the other day that 4 out of 10 youth under the age of 21 have some sort of body piercing or tattooing. What we do know is that there are a number of people that we actually defer when they come in to give blood based on two statements. One, have they had a tattoo in the last 12 months, and have they had body piercing within the past 12 months? And if they answer yes to those questions, we defer them. And that population is only the population that goes through the whole health history process. We have something called a stop sign that occurs prior to them coming to the drive itself. They read that, and that information is also on there. So they will personally exclude themselves from going through the health history if they read that. And there are a number of people, obviously, that know that they can't donate if they've had piercing and or tattooing within the past 12 months. So they just know they don't come to donate at all.
Okay.
We collect 150,000 units a year between platelets and red cells. We deferred 685 people alone last year for this question.
Oh. And we collect about 250,000, and we deferred, I think, several thousand for that question.
Okay. Very good. We have Tamika Nolan from the At Me Tattoo out in East St. Paul. Ms. Nolan?
Yesterday.
It was.
Okay. Thanks for having me again, anyways. Something really
state your
written
name for the record
several
first.
Times.
Yeah.
Oh. Can you hear me?
Yes. State your name for the record first.
Oh, Tanika Nolan.
Tanika.
From Acme Tattoo at the St. Paul, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks.
You may proceed.
We got this real quick, and we also have a life and a lot of things to do, too. So I've changed my letter over and over and over again. We've talked with Representative Bunn along with Artis, with the blood banks, the state of Minnesota, a lot of different things. So I don't know that this particular letter I have tonight is appropriate because I hear that we're going to be working together with this, and that's what's important to us, very dear to our heart. I guess my big thing is... what I'd like to say is I was very grateful for the state of Minnesota and them coming out twice and checking out everything, asked a lot of good questions, Kyle Winnell, and I felt very honored, actually, you know, for our shop to be chosen for you to come out two times to do that and really check out stuff. Representative Bunn has been very diligent in following this last year and for this year and from this time on, which I'm very grateful for. My only concern is that there's some misconstrued stuff with the blood bank stuff that we need to educate people on, some good, some not. Because of piercing and tattooing should be on there, branding, scarification, these things should be on there too. People lie about not having tattoos because they're actually drug users, and they say tattoo instead of that. We have people that work in blood banks that are nurses. So I have first-hand information on that. I'm not trying to take the blood away. I can't anyway with the kidney disease kit, or I would be getting. But that is, it looks better to that person, saying that they got a tattoo or a body piercing versus using drugs. Mm-hmm. So that is an area of concern of mine, along with some other things. We also have a few other concerns, but if we could take a closer look at this review, and we look forward to meeting with Representative Bunn tomorrow and in the next few weeks, I hope that we can work together to come up with a good one instead of a quick one, you know, because... Minnesota has one of the best blood checkers there is, and we have a lot of blood out there. It's only two times a year that there's a shortage in Minnesota. I follow the blood banks very closely up the years. I really don't want the doors to open for prejudice to return again. We've already went through 22 years of my husband and I having a tattoo business, him longer. I really don't want that prejudice to return. We fought very hard to be mainstreamed. Mm-hmm. And so I ask for all of us to work together to keep that.
I know that Representative Bunn is committed to work with everybody on this bill to get some form of consensus before we move forward. And she has committed that to me. And that's why she's taking this bill back up. So I'm going to be on top of that as well. Make sure that you are part of the process as it moves forward.
You know, we can ensure that you're part of the process and that we continue to do that.
Great. Okay. And you know what? You did fabulous last year for us. Great. And you're going to be missed. I've been following you and really like you. And I'm sorry for your retirement. Okay? Yeah. Thank you.
I'll still be around.
Happy to meet
you. Representative Rude?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question to clarify, if I can. I don't know if it's to Dr. Gorlin or to... And it's so good to see you, our kids, together. Or Mr. Kaufman, when the people are coming in to donate, are they asked specifically about tattooing and piercings and other things? Okay, that was my question to clarify.
There's a nod in the audience, meaning yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rude, I must say that with the work that the Health Department did, though, we know there's a much longer list than just those two categories, though, in terms of us to be concerned about. And so one of the things in our discussions, I mean, change on everyone's path that maybe the Red Cross and the blood banks need to update their, you know, questions as well to be reflective of what's actually going on among the public. So, okay.
Members, Representative Root Bunn has committed to move this forward. I think this is an important enough subject that, you know, considering our timeline and our deadlines, I think we should move this forward while we continue to work on this bill before it gets to the floor. Mm-hmm. Representative Bunn, is that something that you're willing to do with the folks?
Absolutely. I'm willing to continue to work and also to come to the parts that we can, you know, hopefully agree on this session. I must say to between the Health Department and myself that we recognize that there are some larger issues in this area that are not even addressed by this legislation, and then parts that are being addressed by this legislation that probably will need some further work or touch-up or improvement down the road. So we do expect that even this session won't be the last that we'd hear of this, that we'll probably need to do some cleanup once we talk about putting this in the field in the next year, and also address some areas that aren't even addressed by this legislation.
Okay, very good. Okay, mm-hmm. Representative Bunn moves that House File 677 be recommended passed as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health Care and Human Services Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries.
Thank you.
Okay, you got your work cut out for you. Okay, Representative Abler. Representative Abler moves that House File 1094 be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Health Care Human Services Policy.
Representative Abler, do you want to move your DE1 first?
Yeah, and I want need to offer a couple oral amendments to it. So I'd like to move the DE1 to get it in front of us, and I'd like to offer an amendment to that. Okay. Maybe I'll wait until you just go. The A2 amendment I'll offer, and I'll incorporate it into my amendment. So I'll just incorporate that, and I have an oral amendment to offer.
Representative Abler, wouldn't it be better if you just move the DE and then you do the oral amendment on the DE?
I can just incorporate them. It's simple.
Okay. Why don't you incorporate?
And then I have an oral amendment that I'll incorporate.
Just wait.
That's fine.
Well, Representative Bunn.
Again.
Representative Bunn, can you take your conversation outside? Representative Bunn.
You want to...
Thank you.
She's just so chatty sometimes. So he's gone. And Mr. My oral amendment on line 2.2, delete or retain. I think staff has this. And then at the after line 234, create subdivision 4. It's one sentence, but it's a very important sentence. Exemption, period. Individuals who have had 5 years of experience working as a surgical technician in a healthcare facility are exempt from the provisions of subdivision 2.
Technologist.
Okay. Oh, technologist.
I believe the oral amendment has been given to staff.
Yeah.
I'll
figure it out.
And I have a copy here with me. Representative Abler moves or incorporates the oral amendment to the DE1.
And Mr. Chair, just a question to staff as we're working on this. I think we use the word technologist and technician, and I think that that may need to be harmonized, but I don't know how to do that yet. So maybe I'll advise if we can incorporate an amendment that the staff will harmonize the word technician and technologist where appropriate. So I'll incorporate that amendment. Is there any questions about that?
Yeah.
Not the technician technologist part, but is my other oral amendment clear to members?
No.
Representative Norton.
I'm sorry.
I'll read it again.
Could you explain, you can read it again, but then would you explain what it's doing?
So subdivision 4 exemption, individuals who have had 5 years of experience working as a surgical, if it's technician or technologist, in a healthcare facility are exempt from the provisions of subdivision 2. And that has to do with, that's a grandfathering clause or a grandparenting clause. If what we're creating is a credential that people will have to function in this very important role. And when you have a world of no credential and then some credential, you have to have a way for people to phase in. And there's, and you'll hear from the steel workers later, there's many people doing this now that had experience and they're wonderful at their work. There are some people, then the decision of this committee is to, will be to create a credential. The people that have life experience, they're very capable, will not be required to get this, but everybody coming into the profession after a certain date will be required to have this credential. So that's the purpose of the grandfathering sentence. It doesn't carve anybody out.
Representative Norton.
I think I have an amendment as well on grandfathering, and so, and I've talked to the...
Right, that's... Oh, okay.
And that's different, so I think maybe we'll just... I just refrain until we get to the point where we're going to put on other amendments, and I'll discuss it then.
Representative Abler has incorporated the...
Right, I'll incorporate
into the DE one.
And then I could, I think, move to adopt the amendment.
Yes. Representative Abler moves the DE one in the shape of the bill that the author wants, as incorporated. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries.
So, Mr. Chair, I won't even offer any thoughts about this except that it's a great bill. And I have some very capable witnesses here.
Very good. I believe we have Ms. Vonnick. State your name for the record, and then you may proceed.
Sarah Vodnick. Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for this opportunity to testify this evening in support of House File Number 1094. My name is Sarah Vodnick, and I'm the president of the Minnesota State Assembly of Surgical Technologists. Joining with me is Rick Vorka of the SEIU and Bob Ryan of the United Steelworkers. These two unions do represent surgical techs in the state of Minnesota. Minnesota's 2,500 surgical technologists are allied professionals who are an integral part of the team of medical practitioners providing surgical care to patients. Surgical technologists work under the supervision of a surgeon to facilitate the safe and effective conduct of invasive surgical procedures, ensuring that the operating room environment is safe and that equipment functions properly and that the operating procedure is conducted under conditions that maximize patient safety. Surgical technologist possesses expertise in the theory and application of sterile aseptic technique and combine the knowledge of human anatomy, surgical procedures, and implementation of tools and technologies to facilitate physicians' performance of invasive therapeutic and diagnostic procedures. Minnesota surgical technologists receive training at 8 Minnesota public and private higher education campuses that have achieved national accreditation, including the Minsky programs in Anoka, Rochester, Duluth, and St. Cloud, and such private programs as St. Mary's in Minneapolis. In 2007, 2.5 million surgeries were performed in Minnesota hospitals, and 2.6 in 2008. Surgical technologists assisted in procedures ranging from simple outpatient procedures to in freestanding surgery centers to complex and highly invasive surgeries such as coronary artery bypass surgeries or neurosurgeries in top hospitals. The Institute of Medicine reports, "To Err is Human, Building a Safer Health System," published in 1999, estimated that over 98,000 patients die from preventative medical errors every year. 60% of 8 never events identified in the IOM report occur in the operating room. The potential for accidental harm to patients in the OR comes from surgical site infections, retained objects left in surgical patients, wrong site surgery, and wrong patient surgeries, falls, medication errors, and positioning the patient in other perioperative tasks. Here in Minnesota, the legislature enacted the Adverse Health Events Law in 2003. This law identified 27 specific preventable never events that must be reported by hospitals. The review of this report issued by the Department of Health shows that nearly 25% of these never events occur in the operating room. These preventable errors include such as leaving foreign objects in the patient after surgery, which happens 74 times in the state of Minnesota.
2007 to 2008 and operating on the wrong site, the wrong patient, or performing the wrong surgery, which happened 78 times in 2007 to 2008. Having competent surgical technologists in the OR does reduce these errors. A review of the data contained in the adverse health events report issued by the Department of Health for 2008 shows that surgical procedures in reporting hospitals without credentialed surgical technologists had an average adverse health event rate for the five specifics to the OR, about 32% greater than Minnesota hospitals that require credentialing. Let me repeat that for you, because this is key why the legislation is before you. Minnesota hospitals do not use credentialed surgical technologists report having one-third more preventable medical errors in ORs than hospitals that use credentialed surgical technologists. Using competent surgical technologists in the OR also reduces healthcare costs to you. Data collected by the Virginia Hospital Association shows that the median daily hospital change in hospitals do not require certification was 3.5% more in 2007 than in hospitals that do require this. This does make sense. Patients with non-credentialed OR staff suffer from more medical errors, which means more complications, second surgeries, and longer hospital stays. These higher costs are passed on to both private purchasers as well as to the state for surgical services provided to program enrollees. Better outcomes and reduced health care costs by having adequately educated surgical technologists is why leading Minnesota hospitals currently seek credentialed surgical knowledge. Job postings from leading hospital systems, including the Mayo Clinic, Alina, Fairview, and Healthies, Benedictine Health, Avera, and Merit Care, highlights the importance of graduation from an accredited program and having been eligible for credentialing. I understand that the Mayo has required for over 20 years that their surgical technologists in Rochester be credentialed. In your packets are job postings from across Minnesota showing the value that hospitals place in credentialed status. Although the data show that use of credentialed surgical technologists reduces medical errors and health costs, Minnesota does not require a surgical technologist to be credentialed at this current time. In fact, surgical technologists are the only healthcare professionals in the operating room that are not required to be licensed, certified, or credentialed, or to have any continuing education. There are no education quality or professional standards for this important profession. So, for example, Chairman Tao, you could be a surgical technologist.
Cool.
Everyone in this room is eligible today under Minnesota law to assist surgeons in invasive high-risk surgeries. No offense, Chairman Tao, but I wouldn't want you in my surgery.
I don't want either.
Can I repeat that, Chairman Tao? All other OR staff must graduate from an accredited program, obtain safe licensure, and receive ongoing continuing education to assure continued proficiency and remain eligible to provide care. The bill before you tonight addresses the deficiency in a very simple manner. Number one, it provides a definition of the functions that are performed by surgical technologists. Number two, a requirement that persons hired to perform these functions must be graduated from an accredited program and have demonstrated their competency by reviewing a national credentialing exam. Number three, like other healthcare professionals in the OR, surgical techs that are hired must have demonstrated their proficiency in this case by passing a national credentialing exam. Also, like other healthcare professionals in the OR, surgical technologists must complete an annual continuing education requirement. The bill would, as Representative Abler did address, grandfather surgical technologists that are not graduates of an accredited program or are not currently credentialed. It also permits hospitals and surgery centers to hire non-credentialed surgical techs if they cannot find one. Unlike some bills that come before this division that are controversial because they seek expanded responsibilities of the scope of practitioner, this bill makes no changes in what surgical techs may do, how they are supervised, or in restricting the ability of other healthcare professionals, such as physician assistants or nurses, to perform the functions of a surgical tech. As you can see in the materials in your folders, credentialing for surgical technologists is supported by two leading national care professionals that serve in the OR, the American College of Surgeons and the Association of Perioperative Registered Nurses. Doctors and nurses do agree that the entire team in the OR should meet basic education functions and competency standards to ensure patient safety and optimal care. I'm not aware of any opposition to credentialing the surgical technologists or requiring that they receive continuing education. We appreciate the input and feedback that we have received before and your interest in parties in developing this legislation. This bill before you has removed requirements from last year's bill that required hospitals to apply for a waiver from the Department of Health to hire a non-credentialed tech. The bill also includes language from the Minnesota Nurses Association. So in particular, with particular knowledge and expertise in the OR procedures, and we appreciated their counsel on this bill. Also, I just want to give you a quick story about one of the hospitals that I work at. I currently work at three facilities, and we had a sentinel event that made the news at one of the facilities I work at, which did have a non-credentialed surgical tech in the room. The wrong foot was operated on, and that did make the local news. And again, that was a non-credentialed surgical tech in that procedure. So I guess in closing, I just want to reiterate that the importance of a surgical tech be certified. Okay. So again, thank you for your attention, Mr. Chairman. And I do, again, have SEIU and the Minnesota Steelworkers here to represent us.
I think Representative Norton has an amendment that might change the direction of the discussion a little bit. So, Representative Norton?
Well, I hope not. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope this actually supports what I've just heard in the testimony, because it's quite compelling. So I'd like to move the A1 amendment, please.
Okay.
And if I could address that?
Sure.
A lot of what we've heard is how important it is to have that credentialed surgical tech in the operating room, and that when there isn't a credentialed surgical tech, the errors increase, and that's the whole point of the bill, which I'm supportive of.
Thank you.
But if we're to take all this to heart, and patient safety and reducing errors is important, then I think my amendment, which would say that we will grandfather in current surgical techs, but that within a year they will actually meet the qualifications and take the exam, I think actually will hopefully decrease errors, but increase the qualifications. And so what I'm asking through this amendment is that we give folks a year after the bill passes to get certified, and then I'm perfectly fine with the continuing education credits. I think that's an excellent idea for anyone working in the operating room and as a surgical tech. So.
I want to thank you for visiting the Rochester School. Thank you.
Yes, I very much enjoyed it. I thought scrub nurses were really nurses. You heard on TV all the time, and so for me it was fascinating, and I really enjoyed the information, and I talked with the folks then about putting this amendment on, and hopefully there isn't any objection to it.
Thank you.
I just have a technical question. Ms. Aves, I know that Representative Avler moved incorporate his new languages at the bottom as well. How does Representative Norton's amendment, how would it impact that? Does she need to do anything for it? No.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't believe there would be any conflict because Representative Abler's amendment exempted people with 5 years' experience from Subdivision 2.
Okay.
So this would apply to people with less than 5 years' experience.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Norton?
Thank you. Well, then maybe we do need to make a change, because I would like this to apply to everyone.
Okay.
And I was not aware of the D1 amendment when we started. I didn't have access to that. So I'm not certain if there's a language change that would need to be
Norton, replaced. Would you want to pull your amendment for now and work on it a little bit while we have the discussion?
Ms. Aves, could I come over? Okay, we'll work on that. So I'd like to temporarily withdraw the amendment A1, get the language fixed, and then I will come back.
Okay, and we'll proceed with the testimony.
State your name for the record. What Sarah said, I thought she did a fabulous job. This is for us just part of improving.
State your name for the record first, then.
Rick Barco, I'm the political director for SEIU Healthcare Minnesota, and I don't have much to add to what Sarah said other than we think this is a great step in improving quality care for patients.
Good. And then we have Mr. Ryan. Mr. Ryan, you may choose to or not to, your choice.
Bob Ryan, United Steelworkers. I concur with everything that was said here today. We just health and safety is our objective in this in this bill.
Very good. Okay, Representative Abler, I believe you got an amendment. The A2, the A2.
I think we incorporated that into the amendment.
Oh, that was okay. It's been incorporated already.
We're ready for other testimony.
Thank you.
think the hospitals want to talk.
Staff informed me that it has not.
That was my first motion to incorporate that, and then the second one was to do the oral one. Well, we can vote on it. It's all the same.
Why don't we vote on it just to be sure?
Chair, I'll move the A2 amendment.
Representative Abler moves the A2 amendment. Explain that just a tiny bit, and then...
Yeah, it just clarifies that they're overseen by a registered nurse, which is common current practice, and there was some question about it, so this just clarifies it. And also says that a person, the second part, a person who's already able to do this isn't affected by this. An LPN, for instance, a higher credentialed person doesn't have to get this credential to do what they're doing. That's the second part of it.
Okay. Representative Abel moves the A2. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Motion carries. Then we have a couple opponents. We have Ms. Olson and Ms. Stout. And I believe you could come and go accordingly. Ms. Olson,
okay.
State your name for the record, and you may proceed.
Make sure you can reach the microphone.
Okay. Well, my name is actually Ann Jones, for the record.
Sorry.
That's okay. You got miscued. And Olson Jones, you know. And this is really a first for me, so I'm... may need a little coaching.
That's fine. We're a very informal group.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am Ann Jones, not Olson. I'm a registered nurse of 38 years with 25 years practicing in the operating rooms. I have literally thousands of hours as both a scrub nurse and a circulating nurse, so I need to correct the impression that surgical technologists are the only... role who provide scrub nurse services in the operating rooms. I'm currently a nurse manager of a large metropolitan OR here in the in Minneapolis. I'm here as a member of AORN, however, the Association of Perioperative Registered Nurses. And I'm not necessarily speaking in opposition of this bill, but to request that we make significant effort to clarify and coordinate this bill with how operating rooms really function. Members of AORN here at the local chapter have reviewed the proposed legislation. We do support creating formal credentialing for the surgical technologist. I don't think there's argument there. It's an important step for any specialty in assuring that basic skills and criteria and educational background are met and that the public safety is assured. But I think it as I read it, needs some work. And I know that there have been amendments offered already as late as today and as late as this evening. But I want to speak to several concerns that AORN has, and the reason that we need to speak is that surgical technologists are part of the nursing staff in a hospital or a freestanding surgical center. Therefore, they are supervised directly by qualified ORRNs, and all regulatory agencies who monitor hospitals and healthcare facilities do require that operating rooms and procedure areas are supervised, managed by qualified ORRNs. Not only that, the technologist is a member of the nursing staff and therefore is supervised by the nursing leadership of these facilities, but also in the room, in the procedure, that surgical technologist works with and under the direct supervision of the ORRN. So I think the bill needs to say that up front. I do appreciate and thank
that was
you for an you amendment.
I think Representative Abel put the amendment in.
It needs to be in the front of the bill, which because it relates to all the tasks that the surgical technologist performs. You heard that the surgical technologist works under the supervision of the surgeon. In the vast majority of instances, they're working under the direct supervision of the RN. They are assisting the surgeon. Surgeons do not employ normally, I mean, in a few instances, they employ a surgical technologist or a surgical assistant, but normally they work for the hospital. Okay? As a member of the nursing staff, okay, the proposed bill should not abridge the rights of others who are qualified to scrub the RN, the LPN, and previously qualified techs, which I think you have said in the bill. So as long as that's clear to everybody, that this does not abridge, that it's a credentialing piece for this technologist, which is great, but it doesn't infringe on others who may perform that role, okay? I need to challenge that there's a cause and effect. We all agree that avoiding the 27 nevers, which is 27 plus 1, now 28, and the first six listed are the first several listed are actually events that can occur in a procedure area. But I need to challenge that there is an established cause and effect between a certified surgical technologist and the adverse events. I have seen no data that suggests that. I've sat in on numerous critical event reviews and of course, read a lot of health safety literature of adverse events that occur in my specialty area, my area of concern, which is the OR. I haven't seen that there's a cause and effect established between errors in operating rooms and the presence of a certified surgical technologist. You need a qualified, certainly, surgical technologist, but there isn't a cause and effect established, so I just need you to know that. Surgical technologists, I think need to be credentialed in a standardized manner with one set of requirements, such as nurses do graduate from different programs of different lengths and have a variety of accreditation processes. Normally, all those accreditations are approved by the Board of Nursing, so surgical technologist programs really need to have the same path. And the test that nurses take and other allied health and allied health non-licensed, I think, are all standardized, whereas the surgical technologists now are tested in two different ways. There's a competency testing center and the NBSTA, which is AST, hires the NBSTA to administer their tests. So there's at least two paths right now. And then the hospitals currently employ as many as 25% of surgical technologists who are either, a few are grandfathered in, not very many anymore, a few are prepared by, you know, in the military, you've got that addressed in your bill, but there are quite a few out there who actually cannot take the NBSTA test. And hospitals would be, I think, it would pose a hardship for us to have to sort out and eliminate those workers and or prove that we had gone through every possible mechanism that we could to find the people certified only as described in this bill.
Ms. Jones, you said 25%?
As many as, yes, in some hospitals. I've talked to a hospital today, four of their 16 techs qualified for the NCCT exam, but not the NBSTA, which is the only one that you're allowing here, the AST.
How many total do you think might...
I really don't have that number. Okay. Had I had more time to prepare, I can't pull the sure. state, but I know in ours, it's 20% of our techs are NCCT versus okay. NBSTA. So I just think that that's... to require that hospitals first sort through sure. all the techs who can qualify for that AST exam or the NBSTA exam would pose a hardship for the hospitals and then prove to you in writing that they couldn't find those, so now we can go to this other pool. I think that's an odd requirement to place on hospitals and surgical centers. It doesn't have to do with opposing being credentialed properly. It's just to prescribe employment practices like that is a little unusual, I think. The bill wants certification recognized by the American College of Surgeons and the Association of Surgical Technologists, but does not mention the Association of Operating Room Nurses, and it's the operating room nurses who are actually supervising the techs. So I have a little difficulty with that. I would think that we would want certification administered by some kind of board, such as a state board. They only refer to a national certifying agency, but I would think to protect the public safety, we would really want them kind of oversight by a board, like
Minnesota Department of Health or some board of allied health professionals, which I don't know if that exists, but similar to the way the Board of Nursing, you know, provides oversight for professional nursing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense, and in a way you're describing a licensure
or certification or something.
Right.
Because even though you have an agency that approves this, that doesn't mean then that they can either give or withdraw the credentials should there be a real competence problem. I mean, right now, the hospitals provide the supervision, the leadership, the competency checks. I'm a qualified OR nurse, so I'm qualified to say that check can perform properly, and that's fine. But if you're going to go for credentialing, you would want a way to have oversight so that those credentials could be either given or withdrawn. And that would be, you know, parallel to other mechanisms that currently exist for other healthcare providers.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Yeah. Good. Representative Norton, are you ready or?
Mr. Chair, just to that last point, this is meant to be a credentialing bill and not a licensure bill. There's many steps along the way, and I think at some point, as we move to a credential, then we can move to registration and some other higher function.
You know exactly what you're saying.
So it's not an opposition to the credentialing goal. It's how we accomplish it that really protects the public and assures that the person is prepared, qualified.
I think from the author's reaction to that last comment, this is the first step of many that will come in 5 or 10 years or some future time. Then, otherwise, there's no credential at all ever.
Right, but I wouldn't pass a bill as written right now. I mean, I would ask that you really stop and think about.
Got it. All right, thank you. We will have Ms. Tao, and then we will proceed to the amendments. Thank you, Ms. Jones, for coming. This is a licensing committee, and we totally understand what you're talking about. So, Ms. Stout, introduce yourself, and you may proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Susan Stout. I am a registered nurse, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing the 149 hospitals in the state. These licensing issues are always dicey issues for us at the association because they involve employees of ours that we care about and that we want to have be happy, and we want good qualified staff in the hospitals. But because these issues are oftentimes tricky, our association has set up a list of criteria that we use for deciding which ones we're going to support and which ones we're going to oppose. And we decided that we would support licensure efforts if there's a documented quality issue that the licensure addresses, if there's a clear path for training of the licensed group in adequate numbers in order to meet the need, and if there's some sort of a statewide committee or commission workforce group that studied the issue and recommends licensure or a change in licensure. On the issue of quality, there was some discussion earlier about the never events. So I actually called the staff person who monitors the adverse event reporting law in the state and asked the question, could you do an analysis of the never events that were related to the surgery and tell me, do we have a problem? I really honestly need to know, do we have poorly qualified people out there who are causing mistakes? I'm going to read you directly the email that I received back. Out of the 73 surgical data sharing reports last year, wrong body part, wrong patient, wrong procedure, or retained foreign object cases, there were no cases, zero, no cases in which lack of knowledge, training, or skills of the surgical technician were cited as the root cause for the event. If the surgical technician was mentioned, it was only mentioned that they were a part of the team present in the operating room. Now, I think that's good news and bad news here. Obviously, it refutes the earlier testimony. But the good news is the people that are working in our operating rooms as surgical technicians are safe. We believe they do good care. Now, we don't oppose the idea of them being credentialed. And nurses are licensed, doctors are licensed, a number of other professionals in the hospital are licensed, and some also are credentialed on top of licensing. When I was a nurse in a hospital, there were a number of nurses that I worked with that held additional credentials beyond their licensure. But the way this bill is constructed, it seeks to provide credentialing, but it does it in such a way that has the force and effect of licensure. And let me tell you a little bit about where that sits in the DE1 amendment. Subdivision 2 says a healthcare facility shall not employ the services of an individual unless they meet those standards. That has the force of licensure, not of credentialing. Furthermore, the bill goes on line 2.16. It says that they then can employ somebody who doesn't meet these standards if we make a diligent and thorough effort to employ a sufficient number of these individuals and make a written record of the fact that we've made an effort. Now, I'm trying to think how a hospital is supposed to implement that piece of legislation. Let's assume I'm out. The old hospital I worked in, Tracy. I'm out in Tracy, and we have we put an ad in the paper, and we can't find anybody who's been through this credentialing. So we hire someone else, and we train them, and we send them off to classes, and we make sure that they're working under the supervision, obviously, of the nurse, and they're working along. And then somebody moves into town who then meets this standard. Are we supposed to fire that person now? Because now somebody moved into town that has that credential? We're not sure how it is that you prove that that you're hiring this kind of person. Do you prove it on an ongoing basis, or is it just at the time that you advertise? How far out do you have to advertise? Out in Tracy, Minnesota, are they supposed to advertise to Minneapolis? Do they have to advertise to Sioux Falls, to Mankato? We're not sure exactly what we would have to do to be able to meet that standard. Then on line 2.25, 2.23, it says that nothing in this section shall prohibit a profession licensed in the state from performing these tasks. So it seems to create an exception for registered nurses or LPNs if they do that function. But further up in the bill, we're prohibited from hiring those people to do that function. So they're not prohibited from doing it, but we're prohibited from hiring them to do that. To be honest with you, we think, based on all of these things, this bill needs a lot of work. We'd be happy to work with the author on a clean bill that either does straightforward licensure or straightforward credentialing. But this, as a template, is a very different approach to licensing and credentialing than we've ever seen here by approaching it through the employment relationship. I guess another thing I want to say before I close here is that licensure standards, there's something about licensing a professional that creates protection for the public. There's a licensing board in the state that oversees that profession, and if there's a complaint against one of those professionals, the licensing board investigates the complaint and takes action. They do things like criminal background checks to make sure that everybody that has a nursing license passes a criminal background check. If if I, as a nurse, did a very bad thing with a patient and a family member made a complaint against me, Ms. Brecken over there would be sending me a note saying, I'm going to have a little talk with you, and we want to review this case, and they might revoke my license, or they might put conditions on my license. This doesn't have any of that. It just prohibits us from hiring somebody who hasn't attended this coursework.
Ms. Stout, how many of the 73 that you mentioned have national credentialing or credentialed by a national board group? The 73 that you mentioned earlier, how many of them were credentialed?
The 73 individuals?
Yeah, that you mentioned earlier.
The 73, these were events, so they weren't individuals. Sorry. These were 73 actual error events that were recorded.
Do we know the percentage of individuals who are not, don't have credentials, who are practicing as surgical techs in the state? Or
Mr. Chairman, all we have is anecdotal information. I think that I might suggest that if we were to prepare to kind of do a good job on this, we might want to do a statewide survey of some kind, and we would be happy to help do one of those surveys. We could survey all of our members. We could find out exactly how many of these folks there are that are out there. We don't know exactly how many folks might be working. A small community hospital could have surgical techs who are part-time, who maybe only work an hour here and there, who may not be credentialed. You know, I don't know unless we did some kind of a survey work, and we would be happy to do that.
Okay. Representative Ibrahim?
Well, thank you, and to the testimony, and I respect what they're saying. But let me offer just a thought on why you would use the employer as opposed to a board. It doesn't rise to the level of a board, I don't believe, and I think at some time it might make sense. You have a group that has, in the state, that has no credential whatsoever in an area that's extremely sensitive. When they came down from the Minsky and they had this demonstration, it was very impressive. As they would work through all that, and this is if there's any topic in the field of healthcare, it's infections and 73 events, and more eyes on the subject at hand, which in this case might be your mother, that can avoid leaving an extra sponge in. Oh, by the way, maybe you want to like work on the correct leg. You know, those kind of things where these people have some talent. And it happens. And it's nobody's happy about it. That's what they're called, never events. But 73 nevers is a lot of nevers. And so the reason in my mind why you would have the employer do this and why there's no taking away the credential and no issues is the employer has a duty to look after its staff. And I would gamble that the smallest hospital of the 129 hospitals that Minnesota has is very careful looking at the credibility of their staff in terms of their background history. They filled out a long form, probably a screening process, and so we kind of trust that the hospital is doing that. All this says, besides doing all that stuff, for the new ones, you got to have a credential that says you've actually been trained at this. And the grandfathering language that I added says if you've been working 5 years, you can change your hospital. And so it's meant to create not a bar and not a shortage, but simply from here on out, that we're going to say that the people with the credential that we see in the scrubs in the audience are going to be the norm for Minnesota. And that's the bill. And it's meant to be simple. It's meant to be cheap. These folks don't make $100,000 a year. They don't have a lot of money to do more things. But they've gone to school. They've invested the time in their classes. And they're dedicated to their work. And as I talk to them, they're really interested in this work. And I think that to inject that kind of interest and that kind of training into the healthcare system can't hurt a bit. So it is a funny bill, but it only adds one thing. Please have this. And there's even plenty of loopholes if they don't, if they have training from the military, if they're working now, etc. So just to add it, just to encourage the committee that this is a good way to go.
Representative Norton?
I'm not sure where we're at with this bill right now, but I am a little confused about the never events discussion we heard earlier. There was testimony that said that facilities with non-credentialed surge techs had a higher rate of never events, and now I'm hearing that there isn't data, and so I'm is that not a true statement, that what we heard earlier? I guess I'm a little confused about what appears to be a controversy and a contradiction, more of a contradiction.
I guess Ms. Stout, and then we will go to
and then if you
Ms.
Like
Bondick to also answer that question. I think it was, go ahead, Ms. Stout.
Mr. Chair, I think it's important to talk about a little bit about the root cause, what a root cause analysis is. When a never event happens, so let's assume someone leaves a sponge in or operates on the wrong leg. When a root cause analysis is done, interviews are done of all the people that were present in the surgical area and before the surgery to try to figure out why the error happened. And they drill down past whether there was a credentialed person in the room or a non-credentialed person to what exactly happened. Who did what? Who didn't do what? Who made the mistake? Who should have mentioned something? And what they try to do is they try to drill into what made that mistake happen. The root cause then is to determine what was at the very heart of the error. And the heart of the error on these surgical errors, none of them was related to the training of the surgical techs. Not one of the root cause analysis showed that. Could there have been surgical techs present who did have the right credential that according to this bill, and others who maybe had a different credential? Absolutely. But the root cause of the event could have been something like, well, here's one that I'll just mention. When an operation occurs on the wrong body part. Let's assume you go in and you were supposed to do surgery on your right knee, and the surgeon makes an incision in the left knee. Did somebody mark the proper knee? Maybe the proper knee was marked. And maybe the nurse, the circulating nurse said, doctor, be sure to do the right knee. This is the one that's marked. And maybe the physician ignored that. Or maybe that they were real busy in the operating room that day and nobody reminded. They didn't go through their checklist. There's a checklist that they have to go through. Those are the kinds of things that we try to drill down to figure out why the error occurred. And in that drilling down, if it looked to anybody there, and they interview not just the surgeon and not just the nurse, but the surgical tech, the circulating nurse, and the nurses that were caring for the patient before they went in, if they felt, anybody felt, you know what? If we'd have had a better trained person there, this wouldn't have happened. It would have showed up as one of the root causes. So it's important to look at cause and effect. Sometimes because there's somebody in the room who doesn't have a particular credential isn't why the mistake was made. And I'm not trying to take because there's somebody in the room who doesn't have a particular credential isn't why the mistake was made. And I'm not trying to take anything away from having good credentialed people. I'm just saying that is not saying that the fact that there could be people hired who have a different credential than this bill calls for causes errors is a leap, according to the data that we have.
Ms. Vonnet, did you want to address that issue as well?
I just want to be clear, you're not disputing that there's more errors in hospitals that don't hire credentialed techs, just that the tech does not cause the error? Is that where you're going?
Mr. Chairman, I'm saying that the cause of the error is not connected in these events that we have registered in Minnesota. The cause of the error was not connected to whether or not a particularly credentialed staff person was there or was not there. Now, it's also important You know how what they say about statistics. It's also important to look deep into general statistics. And I'll just go back to my own roots again, back to Tracy Hospital. You could have one error in Tracy. And we did so few surgeries in Tracy that it would look like a 75% error rate. Because if something bad happens and you don't do it very often, the statistic looks big. So I think that it's really important to instead of looking at sort of an aggregate data, how often was somebody with a certain credential in the room, you got to look at each one of these events and figure out if the error was caused by this poor training. And it would be different if out of these 73 events, 20 of them or 10 of them or even 5 of them were because there was a person there who wasn't trained properly. It was zero.
Okay. Ms. Botner, you could answer if you want. If you don't, it's fine too.
I guess I'm just troubled by the reference to Tracy, Minnesota. There are several small towns across the state and small hospitals that, I mean, they can advertise via internet, via newspaper in the Twin Cities. I mean, there's several credentialed schools around the state that you could grab from this these programs that would put out certified surgical technologists.
Sure. Representative Bunn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, I just want to point out my reading of this bill before it came to committee and then my rereading of it and listening during committee is I absolutely view this as a licensing bill. It is a licensing bill because certification means you can say you are a certified X if you have done what it means to be certified, but it doesn't restrict anyone else from practicing in that area. They just can't use the word certified in front, nor does it restrict anyone from hiring them versus somebody else in any way. So that's what certification is under what we do in licensing in this committee, and that's what the theory of licensing says it is. And so whenever you're saying only this type of person can do the job and be employed in that thing, it is licensure. And we have, first of all, we have 2014.02, which I haven't seen the document. Was that prepared for this particular licensure request? Do we have it? It's not here.
Representative Bunn, it doesn't disallow us to hear the bill.
No, but also, well, so. Excuse me, we do have it on this one. Sorry, I was confusing another one. But more importantly, there's a much higher bar that you really have to establish the case that harm has been done or will be done in order to justify the higher level license, at least for me. That's my bar. And that's the bar in the theory about healthcare licensing generally. So it's wonderful to develop the certification program, but unless we establish that evidence of that higher bar, then I think we're not, you know, this is not the right type of bill for this area right now. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like perhaps the bill is not quite ready. I'm not certain. I'm trying to get a feel for where folks are at the table. And I personally think this is a nice idea to move forward with, and I think requiring certification is a great idea, and I think it's really about patient safety. And I just want to, in lieu of the fact that I'm not sure where we're going, I did have my amendment, and so I would like to move my amendment and then explain why I put it forward, and then we can do what we want.
Representative Norton moves the A1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the A1 amendment is requiring people currently serving as tax, and I'm going to have to make an oral amendment to that as, so I guess I'm going to need to amend the amendment, an oral amendment to it.
You could just incorporate it in.
Thank you. What I will do on 1.5, just for those, after the word technology, I would strike everything up to the comma and insert who is not a certified surgical technologist. And what I'm doing here is, this is an issue I've had not just on this bill, but on all bills that we talk about. I'm concerned about our grandfathering, what we do with grandfathering in this committee.
And I think particularly this might be a nice place to start, although I think we've done it before, is to require that folks currently working in the field who are not certified, should we move this bill forward, have the opportunity to come up to certification, and that we should expect them all to have that same level at some point and not just say, you weren't certified, you don't have to be certified, and we don't care, because I do care. If we think this is important enough to certify, then we need to expect these folks who are going to do it to get that certification in a certain amount of time. And in this particular amendment, I have listed as 1 year. And so I would ask that any currently practicing surgical techs become certified and accredited within a year. So that's my amendment, and it really supports the testimony we heard earlier.
Representative Abler?
Well, thank you, and I don't know how far you want to do testimony on this. I know that, I was just talking to...
Limited.
I'll just speak on behalf of one of the audience members. Mr. Varco, the SEIU, thought this was not necessary, but I'll tell you why I think it's maybe problematic. And it's a blend of... We've got the dueling views here. Representative Bunn is concerned we've gone too far to create a license, and then we're going to... And then this would take it even further to bar those who can do it. And what this bill attempts to do is to create one more thing that they have to have, which is training. and which gives you the credentials arises out of that. And so this would require that everybody has to have this. And I'm afraid then you would actually maybe have a workforce shortage and the issues that were brought about this. And so I think if you start over fresh, I think this would be a good amendment to have. But I think it's a little premature. And so in terms of what this bill will do, people new into the field, those in the pipeline are going to know you better finish your schooling because you have to have this to get the job. People working now who have established their credibility either by having just been hired can keep their job. If you're out more than 5 years, you can go anywhere you want or if you meet other exceptions. So over time, this will move the field into a higher status and a higher training, just the way the bill is. Mm-hmm. And so I mean, the committee can vote how it likes on the amendment, but I think it causes troubles with the bill. So.
Okay. Ms. Ave, can you repeat the amendment just so we have it down correctly? It's not that I don't trust Representative Norton.
I was reading her language, Mr. Chair, but go ahead and let her repeat it.
Mr. Chair, on line 1.5, after technology, delete everything up to the third comma and insert who is not a certified surgical technologist. So the beginning of the sentence would read, an individual who qualifies to be employed to practice surgical technology who is not a certified surgical technologist must.
Got it. Okay. Okay. Representative Bunn, and then we will move to vote on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment, in my view, by the reading, if I understand correctly, further underscores its licensure because you cannot be employed unless you have certification after 1 year. So, again, we have to be clear if we're talking licensure or certification. And, again, mm-hmm. I say that the evidence doesn't justify licensure yet. So the same argument applies.
Okay. Those in favor of the Norton amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Well, how did you vote, Representative Abel?
I voted no.
Oh. No. So 3-0. 3-2.
2-3.
3-2, Mr. Chair. How many fingers do you have?
Amendment does not prevail. Okay, I have my own amendment. I have the A4. I'm going to have to do an oral amendment because I believe Representative Abel already took out the word or retain on my line 1.4 on my amendment. So I move to strike the word or retain. It's just duplicate.
Mr. Chair, can I get a copy? I don't have that one. So.
On line 1.4 on the amendment, we're just going to delete the word or retain. Because Representative Abel already took that out in his incorporation. So, I'm incorporating that in. Essentially, my amendment
is to basically move shall not to may. So, well, just to may, so it's passive. It goes back to Ms. Stout's concern that a lot of the hospitals, if this, the shall is in there, that there'll be difficult. It'll be difficult for the hospitals, and this just moves it to may. They may employ these individuals. At the same time, some of the languages that the surgical techs like gets in there. I know I have talked to both group, and no one likes the amendment. That leads me to believe that's a good amendment. Usually, when compromise are not made, the chair makes it. And I have a good handle on where the votes might be in this on this bill. The chair would vote for the bill if this amendment gets on. So, any questions?
Yeah.
Representative Abler, and then we'll go
Representative Bunn.
Mr. Chair, if you could explain to me how this change doesn't convert it to current law, that would be helpful.
Potentially, it could be in current law, but at the same time, I think it's important to have. I know that the profession wants to move into a licensure, and that is kind of the discussion: is this a certification bill or a license bill? And it is. You're right, Representative Bond, that it is a license bill camouflaged as a certification bill. And so this would move back to current language, but at the same time, some of the language that are important to the surgical text are in the statute, and we could slowly move towards eventually getting to licensure. I believe in that as well. So,
well, Mr. Chair, I have a suggestion in terms of the process. You'll be meeting next week, is that correct?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, I think that you know how I like to work on these things, and I think that there have been enough concerns raised, and I hope you have one more meeting. But I think at this time it would be good to take your suggestions on this language and have the people in the audience consider some more with some more depth. I think the Norton Amendment and those kind of things, and maybe if we it's getting late, and so maybe if we just continue the bill to next week. Then we can work out some of these things with the people in the audience.
So are you suggesting maybe we lay the bill on the table?
That's what I'm suggesting to do, just lay it over.
I believe Representative Rood also would like to suggest that as well.
Actually, Representative Norton could move that. That would probably make her feel.
Representative Norton, you want to move?
I defer to Representative Rood.
Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate what we're trying to do here, but I am not comfortable with moving this forward, and there's a couple of reasons. And I mean, we have three of our eight members are missing. That's a pretty good reason, I think, there in of itself when we're looking at major policy change. And Ms. Stout, I think had some pretty compelling testimony, and I think it is important to look at when we're interpreting statistics and look at the conclusions that we're drawing and make sure we're not making some premature, conclusions from that. I don't know if Ms. Jones never got to respond, but I saw a reaction at some point in testimony. I think it's wrong to characterize what's happening in an OR, that we're just hiring people off the streets and they're just in there and there's no supervision or consequences to having somebody in there who isn't being supervised, because I think there are. And I know that the hospitals are doing the checklist now. I think they're being very aggressive so they don't have adverse effects. So I would be comfortable tabling this bill, and I'm happy to continue working with the parties, but I'm not comfortable with moving this forward at this time.
Okay, I will withdraw my amendment, and Representative Rood moves to lay the bill on the table, and potentially we'll have another meeting.
Thank you.
So the bill has been laid on the table. We don't vote. Do we vote on this? All right, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. The bill's on the table. All right. Representative Rood.
Thank you.
Yeah, so far we're doing all right.
Hey, party's not over yet, everybody. Hey, the party's just about to start, you guys. Hey, you're in the scrubs. Sit down.
Oh, which whale are we now?
Maria's.
Yeah, we have one. What are they? This is the last one.
Dental.
Thank you all for your attention.
Wait,
yeah.
So let's go.
Okay, reps and rule moves the...
I'm going.
Okay, this time, Rep. Abel, can you take your folks outside this time? Yeah. Rep. Wood moves House File 3356. Recommend a pass and refer to the Committee on Health Care and Human Services. Rep. Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and member. Oh, we have three members. That's great. This bill is being brought forward as a courtesy for the Board of Dentistry. It's my understanding that last year during negotiations, it was attempted to insert this language in the dental hygienist bill, I believe is the bill that was in the negotiation. There was some concern that this language had never had a hearing in the House, and we wanted to provide the opportunity for that to happen, and so that's why we are here tonight, so we can have the open civil debate on this.
All right.
With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Schrag, who is the Executive Director at the Minnesota Board of Dentistry.
Introduce yourself for the record, and you may proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ruud, review of the committee. My name is Marshall Schrag, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, and I do appreciate the courtesy of being able to have this bill heard. As Representative Ruud suggested last year, this language was heard in the Senate and got combined into some other bills, including the dental therapist language and the dental assistant licensure language. And during conference committee, it was determined that the House had not heard the debate on this and deserved to do that. And so it's been brought forward to you this year to have you have that opportunity to hear and address. The issue here has to do with clarifying the definition of the practice of dentistry. And the background on that is that teeth whitening by non-licensed providers is not regulated in Minnesota, and yet that procedure holds a risk of harm. Current language does define the practice of dentistry, but it's not been effective for us with regard to enforcement. The board does not have jurisdiction over unlicensed providers, but does receive complaints regularly about them. Those who are believed to be in violation of the Dental Practice Act may be issued cease and desist orders, which have been shown to be ineffective because they're not enforceable. Or we have the cases referred to the city or county attorney, which have also proved to be ineffective because the cities and county attorneys have not shown that they've got the resources to continue an investigation that's been initiated by the board. Board investigations under current language require eyewitness or documented proof of a violation, which is not possible for us to do with our resources for every kiosk, storefront, salon, or trade show throughout the state. The proposed language offers clarification, as I said, focusing on the product, which creates a more effective means for investigating and prosecuting inappropriate practice. The language that's offered here has been recommended by the Attorney General's Office, who is our statutorily imposed counsel and investigative team, and they've done that based upon language that has been introduced in and initiated into the statutes of other states who face the same concerns. This Minnesota is not alone in this. So there is a risk of harm. The risk of harm is that unregulated or unsupervised practice is more likely to result in harm to consumers. And if that harm does occur, then as you've heard before tonight, without a regulatory system, there's really no mechanism to deal with problems or complaints that come up that arise. The safety and efficacy of the products and the services that are provided are questionable. The delivery of the product to the consumer by placing a tray of bleaching product in the patient's mouth or by placing a light or heat source at the consumer's mouth does cross the line of providing a product into delivering a service, and specific expectations are inherent in the provision of a professional service. Patient appropriateness or selection is not typically considered by these teeth whitening businesses, Oral assessment is needed to determine whether a patient is appropriate for the treatment and determine the type of treatment that is most appropriate for that particular individual. We have concerns that informed consent, which is required under our statute of any provider providing any service, that the patient has a discussion with the provider and that they are informed of various options that are available to them and the risks of those various options before they ultimately choose a direction that they wish to go. Contraindications or cautions for patients that should not get teeth whitening services or should have specific types of teeth whitening services include cracked teeth, gum or periodontal disease, the presence of existing restorations, and various patient medications or medical history concerns that would indicate that that person is not an appropriate candidate. We also have a concern that's not directly addressed in this bill, but that does occur and does raise level of concern that has to do with infection control and hygiene with these businesses, where hygiene infection control practices are difficult, if not impossible, to achieve when you have a freestanding space that does not have any plumbing. Adverse outcomes as far as consumer harm include possibility of sensitivity or burning of the gums and lips, discoloration, damage to the enamel, things that are permanent harm to the patients. You know, you're familiar with the Dental Practice Act with Chapter 150A. This includes all of the laws and rules that that a regulated dental professional is required to abide by, the parameters that they must practice under, education, testing, continuing education responsibilities to the board, which protect the public. There are no such protections for consumers of bleaching businesses. This bill would not restrict the businesses that are involved with providing their product unless and until they use a product that carries a higher risk or if they deliver the product inappropriately. So as you'll see, the language clarifies the practice of dentistry language to say that somebody cannot use a product that is a higher concentration than what somebody could buy over the counter. And that's that is all this bill does and in language, but it does allow us to go a long way in protecting the public. So,
Mr. Schrag, I have a question. Currently, does dentists, the current dentists out there, do they use similar products as the, I think some of the kiosks that we see at the mall? Doing bleaching product?
Mr. Chair, the dentists do are involved with bleaching in some of their some practices. The product, as I understand from looking at websites and from talking with representatives of the bleaching business industry, that that they do use similar products. The question is, are those products the same concentration, or are they at a higher level that would be considered prescription grade, and therefore at a higher risk, put the patient at a higher risk of harm?
And Mr. Schrag, the products that the dentists use, have there been adverse effects, like the gum and the lips that you list?
We've not had any complaints to our Board of Dentistry about bleaching adverse effects from a dental practice. So no complaints against a dentist or any other regulated dental professional. We have, however, had a number of complaints about harm from that patients or customers, consumers have received from non-regulated bleaching businesses.
How many the last year?
Over the last year, four or five complaints, two that I have specific harm. I have a photo here that I'm not actually permitted to show you from a complaint because it is private documentation in a closed complaint. But it does show a significant burn to the patient's lip, and it's cause for concern.
Ms. Youngdahl?
Yes. Chairman Tao and members, thank you very much for staying this evening. I am a licensed dental assistant for the last 30 years. I practice in a family practice, and so I'm here if you have any other questions regarding the process of bleaching. It was good to hear this evening about the current concerns with health and safety. I think that's a big concern for mine. I really feel that the product needs to be done under the supervision of a dentist. If an exam isn't done for a patient, and that patient maybe had, and I call them patients because that's what I work with as patients, but a consumer, if they would possibly have a dark tooth in the front, if that wasn't looked at and x-rayed, it could be just a dark tooth, but it could be an abscess tooth, and that's not something you're going to want to place bleaching around. You want to make sure that they don't have decay or internal resorptions or any of the periodontal health concerns. But one of the other big things is if you have existing restorations within your smile zone, crowns, veneers, or resin fillings, if that consumer or patient isn't informed what the results will be, because those restorations aren't going to change with the coloring of the bleach. And so if they aren't informed of that, I think that's going to be a concern, because they're going to get their natural teeth are going to bleach, and those restorations are not going to change.
Very good. Are there questions for the testifier? All right. Mr. Jay Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for giving me this opportunity today. My name is Jay Olson, and I am with the council, or representing the Council for Cosmetic Teeth Whitening, which is a trade group consisting of entrepreneurs, manufacturers, distributors, and retailers of over-the-counter teeth whitening products. I did have a handout that was given to all of you earlier, and that is the council's best practices and information piece of paper. And I want to kind of go into who the council is. The Council for Cosmetic Teeth Whitening is an association that is dedicated to the advancement of safe, self-administered cosmetic teeth whitening products. The CCTW provides information, recommendations, and assistance on a wide range of issues important to members providing these type of cosmetic over-the-counter products, including the safety, the education, training, and appropriate marketing practices. The best practices information that you have there provides recommendations and guidance to the members of the CCTW on a wide range of subjects relating to cosmetic teeth whitening products. The CCTW gathers information from many sources and compiles that information into the best practices and other information. It's not intended to be an exhaustive list of regulations or requirements, but instead to serve as an information resource to the CCTW members. This guide is organized into five main sections, covering compliance, education, training, quality, performance, protocols, and marketing. Those engaged in cosmetic teeth whitening must adhere to the rules and regulations pertaining to cosmetic products. And according to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, cosmetic products are defined by their intended use and not by their composition. Cosmetic products are those articles intended to be rubbed, poured, sprinkled, or sprayed on, introduced into, or otherwise applied to the human body for cleansing, beautifying, promoting attractiveness, or altering the appearance. Cosmetic products are not intended for the use of in diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease. By law, cosmetic products cannot be used to affect the structure or any function of the body of man or other animals. And the council believes that cosmetic teeth whitening services are well within our constitutional legal rights. It's also important to note that the FDA does not categorize teeth whitening products as drugs, but instead as cosmetics. All cosmetics sold in the U.S. are regulated by the FDA under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act. Warning statements are required under the FDC Act when they are necessary to prevent a potential health hazard that may be associated with the product. All warning statements must appear prominently and conspicuously on the label. Adherence to these regulations is very important to all the members that manufacture, repackage, or distribute cosmetic products. Clients must be warned of any reasonable anticipated risks and must be provided with this information prior to participating in whitening services. Cosmetic teeth whitening does not involve any practice related to dentistry, nor is it a replacement for evaluations and other services provided by a dentist. Cosmetic teeth whitening should only be purchased by clients with healthy teeth and gums, and any abnormal condition raised by the client should be immediately referred to a dentist for further evaluation. If a client is in doubt, always refer them to a dentist for an examination. And teeth whitening products used by dentists are typically higher in strength and efficacy than products purchased in over-the-counter retail establishments or those used for cosmetic teeth whitening. Dental teeth whitening products can contain up to 50% hydrogen peroxide or 45% carbamide peroxide. The UV light activation system used by dentists are often quite different. Dentists use powerful UV light sources or lasers, along with higher and more aggressive concentrations of whitening ingredients. Sometimes this is called power bleaching. Cosmetic teeth whitening products rely on a visible light source and a lower whitening ingredient concentration.
So, Mr. Olson, are you saying your product, the strength is not as strong as what the dentists are using?
Correct.
Okay.
All cosmetic teeth whitening products must be self-administered by the end user. It is prohibited for any employee or independent contractor to touch the lips, mouth, or teeth of any client while undergoing preparation for or during cosmetic teeth whitening. Only the clients may insert or remove the mouthpieces, foam pads, strips, trays, etc. Members do not use consent forms. However, they can provide an information form for name, address, telephone numbers for their databases. No questions pertaining to health is asked, as this would be diagnosing. And the same is true for the shade guides, which may be presented to the client to let them make a decision of their shade change, but members cannot touch the mouth, help with the shade guide, or suggest. It's also suggested that seeing a dentist prior to any teeth whitening. And then in conclusion, I guess I would just like to say that the council hopes that instead of banning over-the-counter teeth whitening, that products and services, that the emphasis would be more on putting the five main sections covering the compliance, the education, the training, quality and performance, protocols, and safety. Thank you.
Questions from members? Okay. Representative Norton?
Fight for the mics. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. One is, I heard you talking about some of that these are ill-advised for certain people, but if you're a person that doesn't go to the dentist and you purchase a product or go to a kiosk for care, for whitening, how do you know that you should opt yourself out of participation if you don't go to a dentist and you don't know you have a problem? So I guess that was my first one. How do you know if it's inadvisable and if you don't go to a dentist and the person at the kiosk isn't a trained dentist or able to say you shouldn't do it? And then my second question is, what about the things you purchase at just the Crest strips at the grocery store, and how does this impact that as well?
Mr.
And that
Olson.
May be for the author.
This would fall into the same category as the things that you would buy at the drugstore, like the whitening strips and the gels kits, mouthpieces that you can buy at, you know, Walgreens or Target or anything like that. Falls under that same category. In regards to knowing if the client has issues, unless they know themselves or, you know, say something, there is no way, you know, to know, other than then suggesting if they haven't been to a dentist for cleaning or things like that, and they divulge that information, then to suggest to them, maybe you should go see your dentist before you do this and have them give you your recommendation whether or not to come back here to do it or to have your dentist do it.
So, Mr. Olson, your folks, they don't do exams and make recommendations?
No.
Okay. Representative Bunn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Olson, and I don't know if you had the language of the bill in front of you. Do you have the
language? I don't have it in front of me at the moment.
Two things. First of all, to clarify, it's my understanding then that the products that you use in kiosks, lawns, storefronts are no stronger, whether they use the peroxide or the hydrogen peroxide or the other peroxide, the carbon, whatever, are no stronger than what is available in drug stores in various forms. Is that correct?
Mr. Olson?
That would be correct, to my understanding. They're not dental grade, like the 45 and 50% grades that some dentists may be able to.
So, Mr. Olson, the language of the bill is we're not banning teeth whitening products by the language of the bill. It says that you can't perform these activities unless you're dispensing or using a product that may be purchased over the counter for a person's own use. So that's the language. In looking at that line, so it's line 3.17, is there, or maybe mine's an old version.
Yeah.
2.13.
I think the problem might be in 2.13.
No, I'm looking at the
2.9, it looks like.
Yeah, 2.9. So, it's actually 2.11 I'm talking about. So, the question I have for your industry, is there anything in that line that, if this were passed, would not allow you to continue?
No, I don't believe there would be.
At the same time, you're already in compliance, essentially, with that, right?
Yes, because it's right. Already an over-the-counter product that right. The customers can buy. We just provide the means for them to be able to use it in our businesses.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
To Mr. Schrag, then. Given that they are... Do you have any evidence for in the state of Minnesota that this language is currently being violated and that they are somehow obtaining commercial dentistry professional level products and violating this level of practice, which is consistent with what they're approved of as a cosmetic and through FDA?
Mr. Schreck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, do I have evidence? No, we have reports that that's happened. And I think the concern is that I don't see a lot to argue with about the criteria that he set forth as far as those members who follow the guidelines that they've established. Mm-hmm. Those seem pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. The concern is when that doesn't happen at the retail level and when it doesn't happen because there are people who are able to obtain franchises or provide services that are not members of the association that would have those kind of ethics established. Mm-hmm. So there are certainly companies and individuals providing these services who are not members of the Council for Cosmetic Teeth Whitening. Mm-hmm. We have seen harm done to patients. And the concern is that this... Right now, as I said, with the language, the current language of our statute that talks about what the practice of dentistry is, I can refer you to the previous page on. There we are on lines 1.21 and 1.22. Whereas it is the practice of dentistry if somebody offers and undertakes by any means or method to diagnose, treat, or remove stains or accretions from human teeth or jaws. We believe that does indicate that the bleaching dentistry has been accepted as bleaching teeth has been accepted as a practice of dentistry. This helps clarify it so that it's specific to somebody who does that outside of the parameters that are established, which is that they need to be at an over-the-counter percentage or level. Mm-hmm. So, no, it shouldn't put anybody out of business that is complying with what's been discussed here tonight. Mm-hmm. And what it does do is give us the opportunity through the legal processes to ascertain and stop somebody from doing that if they have violated that standard.
Representative, follow up or no?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some contact with the manufacturers in this industry over the interim, and all the evidence provided by manufacturers is that they are providing this industry with over-the-counter strength products consistent with the regulation of FDA and as a cosmetic. So I think that there are issues potentially about whether or not, even though it's in their best practices, whether or not best practices occur on the ground, in the field, in terms of whether or not consumers are adequately are informed or about possible contraindications, and then make that evaluation for themselves whether or not they should continue with getting whitening. So it's my sense from that it's not about the product. It's about that if Mr. Schrag, if the Board of Dentistry is concerned about safety and contraindications based on the status of that individual's teeth or gums, that if you brought forward a proposal to say that we will require that a form, information sheet be given to individuals who come into these shops or kiosks that explains to them the kinds of things that they should consider as inappropriate conditions before going forward. If you ask us to maybe consider requiring that to be provided them, that would seem a reasonable thing. It's inconsistent with the own best practices recommendations here. But I'm not seeing any evidence about products. I am, maybe you can explain to me, though, that who does sell the professional grade products that the dentist obtain. I'm not sure where that is from, but that's not, from what anything I could tell, the source for this industry in our state. So if you have any alternative evidence about people hijacking dental grade products that are not considered cosmetic, making them wear in the way in their system, you know, we could hear evidence about that. So,
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Schreck,
Representative Bunn, I think that I would turn that over to Ms. Youngdahl to address where the dental offices acquire their materials. She works and has worked in a dental office for a number of years, and would be able to address that. I do want to inform you, though, that the language that we're bringing forward was put together by wiser minds than mine. And like I said, this is the recommendation of our council that has come forward and said, yes, we've studied this across the country. We've seen what other states are doing. We've seen what restrictions there are about enforcing these statutes that different states have. And this language was thought to be language that would protect the public.
Ms. Youngdahl?
Yes, Chair Tao and members and Representative Bunn. The office that I work in uses from one manufacturer, and that is UltraDent, and they make opalescence, and they only sell their products to dentists. They do have concerns, and they do monitor offices if they're ordering frequently, and many of them, to make sure and follow up to make sure that they're not being used outside the dental practice. But my understanding is the over-the-counter products, either if it's the hydrogen peroxide or the carbamide peroxide, that it's between a 3% and a 9% over-the-counter, and dental offices generally start at a 10% and higher.
Okay. Mr. Schreck, last year the bill included $300,000, I believe, dollar appropriating from the special revenue fund, potentially when it passed, to defend potential lawsuits, and I didn't see that in this bill. Is that still anticipated?
Chairman Tao, I guess I had not recalled that was the case, but that actually is true. We put together a fiscal note that was requested last year for the bill, and based upon what was happening in other states, there was an anticipation that retailers and organizations such as has been represented here tonight have sued states in other jurisdictions, and we thought we needed to be prepared for 2 to 3 cases that might come forward.
So you assume this, then it is safe to assume that it would cost about the same if this were to move forward?
I'm not hearing anything from Mr. Olson that indicates that they would have objections that would cause them to file such a case. Okay. So I don't believe that would be that would be necessary, no.
Okay. Is there anyone from the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay. Okay.
be my guest. And then I would like to vote on this before 10 o'clock. State your name for the record, and you may proceed.
My name is Misty Farnham, and I've been a certified nationally certified and Minnesota licensed dental assistant for 17 years. I have taught at the University of Minnesota Dental School for 5, and I've also worked with one of the top cosmetic dentists in the country. I'm currently overqualified in my position as a dental assistant, so I've been unemployed the last 3 years virtually until I ended up, by the grace of God, getting a job working for Wow Smile Express at the Mall of America. I am very proud to be now a manager of that company because I sell a phenomenal product that I completely believe in and actually makes me thrilled to do dentistry again. Charging $500 to $800 for a light treatment that's a power boost treatment to a patient at the dental office, I never felt comfortable doing for somebody. It was a treatment that, in most cases, more often than not, they got extreme sensitive teeth from, which is very achy and can last for several hours, and burning gums, no matter how careful you were with barriers and a dentist was in the office. The product that I sell over the counter in a kiosk does not create blanching such as I got in the dental office. And I get consistent results without the sensitivity that I got in the dental office. And I'm only charging $99 and not robbing the consumer. I consider this bill an anti-consumer bill and a pro-dentist bill the way that they are presenting it. We use sanitary wipes on a regular basis on everything. Their concern with dentistry is that there's a lot of saliva, and it's not very sanitary. There's no aerosol spray whatsoever in our kiosks, so there's no worry about all the saliva contamination that there is in a dental office. In fact, all dental personnel are required for OSHA requirements to view a movie called, it shows red saliva. They dyed saliva to show how much aerosol spray sprays all over an office. We do not have saliva all over our chairs and lights and such. We wipe it down thoroughly. Also, because I have such a background, I have thoroughly taught my staff. They continuously call me with any questions as to how to assess teeth. We are not practicing dentistry. We stress that to people. I constantly refer them to dentists if it looks like there's any type of questionable thing. And I always make sure that I point out to them, this tooth has this mark. It may come out this way. You have a mark like this. If you expect this, this may not be what you want. I have more complaints about Crest white strips and dental procedures that come to me on a regular basis of burnt gums and lips. And I'm selling a product over the counter, and nobody regulates Crest strips. So why do they want to keep regulating us the way they are?
Thank you. Is there?
And I do have examples of the product that we use.
All right. You can pass it, and we'll all use it for a while. Okay. With that, see no more. No members are interested. We'll proceed to vote. Representative Rube removes her motion. The House File 3556 be recommend pass, and 3356 be referred to pass. Move on to the Committee on Health Care and Services Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye. No?
No.
The noes have it. Bill does not prevail. Okay. Thank you. Meeting adjourned. Is this okay?